Now it's time for ice cream. Or maybe some nuts. A cool glass of orange. Why not try a hot dog? Or the real thing, a cool, refreshing Coca-Cola. From the sales staff and in the foyer. Now.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 15th of March 2024, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and not Google Play for the usual reasons. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on their heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III wage slavery lies. People like George Galloway, for example. Anyway, we'll be hearing a little bit from him tonight, and also we're going to be taking a special dip into the band Russia Today, RT. Some interesting stories there, which you're not allowed to hear. And also interesting guests, sort of people like Martin and I over the years have been popping up on RT the whole time, but you won't hear us now in the British, because we've been banned, haven't we? So Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks want us slaves to their machines. Huxley's diabolical plan rewards only blind obedience, folks. Meanwhile, pantheist wife-murdering WEF King Champon Charlie wages war on the British people as well as China, this time via the Conservative Party, maybe soon via the Labour Party too. And he's waging war on us and China, Russia and the BRICS. Great fun. Well done, Charlie. And with regime change maniac sidekick and referendum failure Diddy David Cameron. So, helping us navigate the WEF's fourth industrial revolution, the fourth Reich matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
We'll be also looking at the state pension. Is that under threat? Last week we chatted to... just ask you this about this directly, Martin, to Steve Headley. But he's the author of The Death of the Left. But Steve was hinting that the whole national insurance thing is a farce. It doesn't make any difference. All the money goes in the same pot. And what Labour have been saying this week is actually it's about the principle of the welfare state and the principle of the idea of national insurance. He's saying that the Labour are saying this is a way of eroding people's any expectation that they may get a state pension in the years, in the decades to come.
Well, he's quite right that the money that's put into the national insurance pot does not, it's not a separate pot. It's just another tax, basically, on people's income, like income tax. And of course, at some point, it may well be, this is what happened in Russia in the 90s, in the Soviet Union, as it then was that people who'd worked all their lives expecting a pension were told that they weren't going to get one, or B, they were supposed to get one, but they weren't going to get one anyway, or C, when it finally arrived, it was worth a fraction of what it had previously potentially been worth. So a whole generation of elderly people in Russia just died, which is one of the reasons why, in the elections this week, the survivors are not going to vote for pro-Western candidates.
No, they certainly won't, if there are actually any left, because we'll be hearing, oh God, I mean, I wonder if they're funded by the West. This was the big principle, wasn't it? You can have a Russian that's actually quite pro-West, but if there's CIA money or MI6 money, or, the UK foreign aid budget is paying their wages, quite obviously the Russians are not having that, whereas it seems that we don't care if the Israeli government is paying the wages of the Labour Friends of Israel or the Labour or the Conservative Friends of Israel, which is bigger.
Well, that's right. I mean, the idea that people countries don't interfere in other countries' elections is strictly for the birds. CIA and the British have been interfering in elections and electoral processes all over the world for donkey's years.
Isn't this a no-brainer? You don't allow foreign countries to fund your political candidates. Why would you?
Well, the thing.
Unless you're a globalist.
Well, I mean, the thing is that in some countries, they're not in a position to say no. And of course, you know, the funding of, you know, don't forget politics does depend upon on hard cash. And therefore the temptation to take such money is quite strong, because otherwise you can't do anything.
Okay, well, I'm going to crack on with our little introduction, because we'll be also hearing from the sacked Chief Inspector of Borders, David Neil, speaking out about Heathrow and about Manston, and also the cancelled, he must be cancelled here in Bristol. Dear Moodley is a Bristol pastor who has won his battle with the police to be able to speak about issues in the Bible on the streets here in Bristol, in Broadmead particularly, where he goes on a Saturday. Many Saturdays you can see him and his crew and his team down there basically just reading the Bible out and getting abused for it in various ways. He's one of the most interesting things he told me was that it's the local Muslim community that have been complaining mostly to the police about what he's saying, calling it hate speech. But anyway, the police have now come down on his side, saying, well, we think that we overreacted by telling him he couldn't talk about these things. So we'll be hearing from Dear Moodley. Bizarrely, nothing in the Bristol press or the regional press has covered Dear at all. Yet he's been on Fox News, he's been on GB News, he's been in the Daily Mail, he's been in very many national and international fora, but not in Bristol. Like, they don't care. I remember him saying, actually, when he was on here last year, that the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees passed him when he was preaching. He said, we don't want your kind of Christian in his city, that sort of thing. So obviously the broadcasters think the same. Also in part two, World Without End or End of the World, the Third Temple project, and we'll be also looking at this idea, is it Lucifer or Satan? What are these people actually looking at? What are they watching? Is there a difference? What is the difference? In a more prosaic but more practical way, the miners' strike 40 years on. Arthur Scargill has called this week Israel a fascist state. He's the miners' leader in the 1980s, and also non-zero carbon scientists have been attacked. We also have some more on Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy who flew bizarrely to Britain in 1941 in a Messerschmitt, and then was banged up for life in Spandau in Berlin. Why did the British government say he bailed out when in fact he did an emergency landing in a field he thought was next to the home of the right-wing Duke of Hamilton? The real extremists, and this is the biggie, isn't it, this week, the real extremists, the dysfunctional Home Office is protecting the far-right Order of the Nine Angles, folks, and their links to the Christchurch mosque massacre and potential murders here. What makes them tick? We hear from Andy over in Dunedin in New Zealand about a bit more about the Order of the Nine Angles. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not cancelled here yet. So I suppose we should really start, Martin, by looking at this, I think, fascinating sacking of the Chief Inspector of Borders. So let's just get straight into that. I mean, his name is he's a former British soldier who was in the military police over in Afghanistan. His name is David Neil. Have you followed this? I know we covered it briefly a couple of weeks ago, but the idea that there is no longer any Chief Inspector of Borders or Immigration in Britain.
Well, I have followed it, but obviously not in the detail that you've done.
So what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, what he's saying is that, you know, as somebody who's supposed to be looking into how it's run and whether it's run properly, he's concluded that it isn't being run properly, and he's been elbowed out by the people in charge, saying that he's a troublemaker.
He's being partisan or even-handed or what?
Well, I listen to what he has to say. It's obviously they don't want to hear what he's got to say. They've tried to shut him up. And that always interests me when people are being shut up. Why are they trying to shut him up?
What I find so fascinating is he's megaly even-handed. He comes across as extremely professional, very, very good guy. He's been criticising the places like Biggin Hill Airport in Kent, and also London City Airport, for allowing these executive jets to come in with no proper passport checks.
Well, I think that was the thing that stuck in my mind when we talked about it the first
time. But also,
if you are a wealthy person in a private jet, you can come into this country without any checks at all.
It sounds like a mafia state.
Well, that's right. Well, I mean, that's perfect for those who are wealthy criminals, isn't it?
It is just perfect. Oh, yeah, no checks for you, sir. Yeah, we'll just nod you through. And he actually was one of the individuals that went down himself with his clipboard to notice these things and to see what was going on. So he's, without any warning. But he's also critical of what's been going on at on the channel with the channel crossing. So let's have a listen now to David Neal. He was on, he didn't do a proper interview. He did a sort of podcast thing with the Today programme, a couple of BBC journalists. I always find it a bit weird when you have two journalists interviewing one person. And it's Nick Robinson, I think, is the main talker on here. So here's, David Neal talking about this time Heathrow. It's a quite, it's about, I think, about 40-50 minutes. I'll put the full version of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where he talks about the e-passport gates, the chaos which has been going on at Heathrow Airport. He went down to inspect that.
So when it came to e-passport gates, you know, I was there at Heathrow Airport with the team, and I saw many of the things that were reported on myself.
What? What did you see?
Well, we saw the Border Force officers, for example, you know, who aren't equipped with communication devices, not equipped with radios. So we're in this ridiculous position where the front line of defence at the eighth busiest airport in the world, the attention of officers who are working there is attracted to their colleagues by, you know, whistling or waving or, you know, which is absolute madness. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, the public want to hear that. And I'm pretty sure that the public would think that's appalling. Everyone seems to have a radio this day and age.
Isn't this bizarre? So you've got the, at the borders, they're not issued with radio, so they've got to whistle across the arrivals hall to attract the attention of another person in order to tell them what's going on, or even shout potentially personal information across the hall in order to get the attention. Why haven't they got radios? Why aren't they, you know, simple stuff, isn't it?
Well, I mean, he's raising these questions, and I'm going, yes, I can see that that's an issue.
Well, he also talks about Manston, which is the reception centre for asylum seekers crossing the Channel.
The reasonable capacity of the site had been overwhelmed, and what we'd seen was a sort of a creeping lack of ambition on the part of the Home Office to build proper facilities. So what we had was temporary facilities, was tented buildings, whereby asylum seekers, you know, sometimes, you know, several hundred were inside single tents, effectively, you know, heated tents, but nevertheless they were sleeping on kit mats or roll-up mats on the floor with blankets. They were sleeping, you know, next to each other. You know, this was like a sort of, you know, the refugee, you know, situation that you see overseas.
Often very traumatised people that have been on a very hazardous journey, to put it mildly.
Absolutely, and you've got children, you've got families there, you've got grown-ups there who've, you know, many of them are still in the clothes that they've worn when they've come across in the inflatables. You know, so it's a pretty grim place. And what wasn't happening was they were not moving on into hotels within the system. So the idea would be that there'd be a free flow of people coming through, that people would be there for no more than 24 hours. So in effect, it's a police holding cell, in effect. My background, working in for a number of years in Afghanistan and assuring UK detention facilities in Afghanistan, where, you know, hundreds of suspects, you know, had been taken into detention, many of those suspects subsequently convicted of killing British soldiers and NATO personnel. We never had a plan to be beastly to those people. We dealt with them in as transparent a way as we possibly could, and as well as we possibly could, to really high standards.
Do you think the conditions were worse in Manston than they often were in Afghanistan when you were having to detain people who were terrorist suspects?
I think that would be fair to say, and even to the degree when I saw children housed in at the children's holding facility called the Kent Intake Unit down at Dover Docks, and I'd written to the Home Secretary. I was that appalled by the conditions that I saw. I'd written to the Home Secretary to say that these were worse than the conditions that I saw in Afghanistan. And I think that's one of the frustrations that I've had, is that I've not had access to ministers as quickly as I should have done in order to bring that sort of thing to their attention.
Okay, so he's explaining pretty clearly what's going on. It's absolutely appalling conditions down there, inhuman conditions, the sort of thing that, you know, Stanford prison experiment type stuff going on, with people being stuffed into far too small a space, forgotten about, not given proper cleaning, washing facilities, all this sort of stuff. And he, when he wants to raise it with ministers to try and get something done about it, he's just given the cold shoulder.
Well, underlying all of this is the policy of the government, as egged on by the Tory media, to make it as difficult as possible to apply for asylum in Britain, and to make it as unpleasant as possible, in the vain hope that people will just go away and they won't have to deal with the issue.
It's not unpleasant for the super rich in their business jets, is it?
No, but I mean, he sounds like a professional sort of guy.
Nick Robinson, to be fair, did ask him that. Do you think they're making these conditions deliberately awful? And he said, absolutely not. No, this is just that the people who are involved don't have the budgets to actually do the job properly, and anyone that does care is ignored.
Yeah, but they don't have the budget to do the job properly, because if they made the budget to do the job properly, the ideology is that more people would turn up to live in cushy accommodation and all the rest of it. And so the policy has been to starve the border facility people of the resources to provide decent facilities, because that supposedly deters people who are fleeing from Afghanistan, Syria, or wherever.
So he's saying he's saying it's not part of the policy.
Well, I mean, don't forget, he would say that because he's trying to be even-handed, as you say. I'm making the point that they've been deprived. We've got up 30,000.
They're depriving the super rich of anyone to check their passports too. It's surely just that they just don't have the money to do it, or this is not a priority. The money's all going to places like Ukraine.
Yes, it's not a priority. You are right. And it's also because it's not a priority. They don't care about prisons either. You know, the prisons are overcrowded and on the brink of collapse.
But of course,
there's no votes in helping, in making decent prisons.
I was listening to Times Radio, I think, earlier on today, and they were saying, oh, I never listened to Question Time. Last night's BBC Question Time was one of the best I've seen for a long, long time. Not only did they have a couple of very feisty guests, one guy from the Scottish National Party, but also some really good contributions from the floor. And they were tackling some really good issues, like the one you've just described about prisons. There was another thing about extremism. Very, very good discussion and debate. We'll be hearing about that in a minute. And also Gaza too. Yes, so Gaza came up again. So we'll be hearing that in a minute. But finally, from David Neal from this podcast, like I say, there'll be a full version of it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. David Neal talks about the way he was sacked, because is it James Cleverly? I think it is, isn't it? Who's the Home Secretary?
Cleverly is Foreign Secretary.
No, he was. Got booted out for camera and he got shifted into the Home Office.
He's been shifted sideways.
Anyway, as David Neal explains, actually, he's quite convinced that his sacking was right from the top, from Sunak's office and from the Cabinet Office, or from Downing Street. Nothing to do with, because Cleverly was backing him, which I thought was quite interesting.
James Cleverly wanted to keep you in post and was overruled by Downing Street, who said he needs to go.
As I understand it, yes. I've seen evidence, I've seen disclosed material as part of the judicial review that says that ministers, having seen them in January, approved my reappointment. The Home Secretary approved my appointment. It went through the Cabinet Office, and then we went to Number 10, and it was Number 10 that turned it down. I can't tell you, I've not seen material as to who in Number 10 turned it down.
Now, to be fair to them, wouldn't they say, those people who didn't want you reappointed, that David Neal became frustrated because he didn't get meetings with ministers he wanted, and he didn't get his reports published, and he did eventually talk to a paper, and therefore he had to go?
No, I have to correct you, Nick. Yes, you would be right, apart from the fact that the material about the reappointment took place before the sacking. So there's two issues here. One is the non-reappointment, and then secondly is the sacking. Now, I think the question to ask is, why did Number 10 go over the top of the Home Office not to reappoint David Neal, who clearly the current Home Secretary and the ministers assumed was doing a really good job? Now, the subsequent sacking is something slightly different.
Yeah, so in other words, just to be clear to people, you did, out of frustration, get a report to a newspaper, but that was after that decision.
Correct.
Am I putting two and two together and making five? Because it seems to me you say, the Prime Minister didn't want to reappoint me. I don't know why, but it stopped me scrutinising his very controversial policy about Rwanda. I think I might have just worked out why.
Well, I don't know, Nick. I work on evidence. I work on what I've seen, and I've not seen that. But that would be for someone like you to be able to make the connection.
So here's a little bit of, there's various things he can't say, various things he can say. I thought fascinating looking into, first of all, he says there's a judicial review, so he's taking the government to court about what they've done to him. Secondly, the idea from the Home Office was that he'd be reappointed. Let's just get this chronology right. So that would mean he would be into the next government too for a couple of years at least. Then there was a decision from 10 Downing Street which overrode that. And that, it seems to me, is what has caused him to blow the whistle. He's saying, well, look, I've done a good job. I'm doing a good job. I know I'm doing a good job. And if Downing Street's going to override the Home Office to try and get rid of me, I think it's around about April this year, then I might as well just speak out. While I've got the chance, and that's at the point at which he was sacked.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, he needs to get his story out there, because otherwise we wouldn't know about it. The politics of all of this inside the cabinet are probably extremely poisonous.
He refused to do interviews with anybody except for that. apart from, I think he's done a couple with the, for the Daily Mail, as well. That's the only broadcast interview he's done. So, I mean, I just find it, it shows utter toxicity within the Tory party. And the, I think the biggest point of the lot really is the one that the, BBC's Nick Robinson makes there. Whereas this is very convenient in the run up to a general election with this disastrous Rwanda policy we know is not going to work, to have no Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration.
Well, especially one that's going to be critical.
Well, none at all. There won't be even anyone to blow the whistle, because anyone in the job.
Well, if I was Keir Starmer, which I'm not, I would say it's just evidence of the absolute total incompetence of the government. You know, they're in the terminal stage of collapse. They don't know what they're doing. There's nobody in charge, and they're trying to electioneer at the last minute in various ways, in various registers. But, you know, the basic stuff of government has come to a halt a long time ago.
Yeah, certainly seems to have done. On BBC, as I mentioned at BBC Question Time, a really good edition, I have to say that. I don't often say that. We usually call it Borrow Time at home. But anyway, they had a good one last night in Liverpool, and there were two main subjects covered, which I thought were well worth talking about today. One is this business of the scandalous accusations by this £15 million Tory donor. What do you make of this about Diane Abbott, Martin? And then on the same, literally on the same day, you've got Rishi Sunak. Actually, no, it was just a few days before Rishi Sunak, and then Michael Gove talking about the new definition of extremism, including out of the eight groups they mentioned, six of which were Muslim groups.
Well, I mean, the thing that strikes me is £15 million for the Tory party. That's far more than the trade unions give to the Labour Party. And that's how our politics is run. Wealthy people buy what they want. And the rest of us, you know, I pay my subs to the Labour Party, most of which then end up being given to Labour Party insiders accusing the party of anti-Semitism. And meanwhile, the Tories get he must be fantastically wealthy to be able to afford 15 million quid.
Yeah, he's so wealthy, he can be a racist and no one dares to criticise him.
The other thing, of course, he's made his money in contracts for the National Health Service. Now, maybe the fact that he's giving this money is because he's made his money. The National Health Service should, in fact, have in-house people doing their IT. If we were a socialist country, that would be the case. But, of course, we don't have in-house people to do the IT. We have to buy in people to do the IT, people like him. And if they've got the political connections, having given 10 million to the party, then he's the one who's going to get the contract.
Yeah, I mean,
nobody's asked these questions.
Fiona
How
Bruce,
did he get that contract?
Fiona
Where
Bruce,
does his money come from?
I'm not a big fan of Fiona Bruce, as you might have guessed, the lady from the Antiques Roadshow. And we had Claudia Bullin on this show a few weeks ago, who brought up Gaza, started shouting out at Question Time, basically heckling Fiona Bruce to, why aren't you talking about Gaza? And this is because they hadn't talked about it for weeks and weeks. This is, I think it was in January. And Claudia is down in the Medway towns, in Gillingham, there where they had a Question Time. She got on, did, I thought, a fantastic job in bringing it up, even though it wasn't mentioned in Question Time. So they started to talk about it in Question Time. Now we're hearing about that in a minute. But it seems there's a little bit of, I mean, one of the problems with her, Fiona Bruce, is she was trying to shut down the discussion on the, about Gaza last night to move things along. And someone obviously whispered in her ear, yeah, but you've got people on the panel who haven't had a chance to say anything yet. So that's how much she wants to shut the discussion on Gaza down. She's not comfortable about it. And Melanie Phillips, we'll be hearing from her in a minute. But let's start by listening to this section. It's about 5 minutes or so, where they talk about this horrific scandal with Diane Abbott, the first black Labour MP, and she's been actually expelled.
First black woman Labour MP.
First black woman Labour MP, thanks Martin, and then she's been suspended from the Labour Party for quite a long time now, not even sure why, but anyway, this Tory donor feels that because she's a pariah in the Labour Party, that she's fair game. Anyway, let's have a listen to the discussion and Question Time.
We are stopping people misusing our values. We shouldn't be naive in this country. If we believe in liberal democracy, we have to fight for it.
Stephen.
Look, the good news is that this Conservative government is coming to an end. The bad news is that they've not realised it yet, so they're going to spend. So they're going to spend whatever time they have left seeking to divide, deflect, and distract from the chaos of the last 14 years, austerity, public services on their knees, the damage of Brexit, a Prime Minister who lied, a Prime Minister who crashed.
Okay, but Stephen, about the question, the question from Louise is, will it actually prevent extremism?
And this is an important point, because we cannot allow ourselves to fall for that distraction. We need to make sure that we do, as the good people of Liverpool have done since 1983, and the people of Scotland have done since 1955, and reject the Tories at the ballot box. And when it comes to extremism, I think someone should provide Lee and the Conservative Party with a mirror, because the only people who have threatened parliamentary democracy on these aisles are the people who closed, shut down the Westminster Parliament illegally, the people who seek to undermine the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Parliament at every turn, and the people who accepted £10 million from someone who was racist and calls for one of my parliamentary colleagues to be shot. That is extremism. And Lee needs to hold a mirror up to himself and his own party.
And not a word, Stephen, in any of that 2 minutes about how we actually solve extremism in this country. Not a single word. Just a load of partisans.
Well, here's a suggestion for solving the immediate problem that we face with regards to the challenges in society. A party who paroled Parliament illegally, a party who ignores the devolved settlement in Scotland and Wales,
and a party who accepted money from
a racist who called for an MP to be shot, you get rid of the Conservative Party. That's what you do.
I think this idea of tackling extremism, if you're going to be serious about it, you have to engage with people, you have to understand what's happening in these communities, you have to work with people in the community. And what I have been seeing cynically over months, I'm sure you've all seen it here, is using extremism as a fig leaf actually to promote a lot of anti-Muslim and Islamophobia in this country. And I find it extraordinary that in the week that we have had these comments from this Tory donor, where the Conservative Party took a whole day to even define what racism is, they sent ministers out on the morning round saying, this guy hadn't been racist, he had just been a bit rude. He talked about shooting a black woman, not any black woman as well, our first ever elected black woman in British political history. This is a party that couldn't even define that as racist. How on earth are they going to define what extremism is? I will come back to you.
Where comments are wrong, they should be called out. But ultimately, if we give people a second chance, if we say, actually, you still have something to contribute in whatever way, be it MPs or within the political process, I think we are better as a society for doing that.
OK, I just want to come back on that, because it is a disgrace to lump other politicians like Angela Rayner in with what that racist said. Hang on. He didn't just make a bad comment about people. He said Diane Abbott made him want to hate all black women and he wanted to shoot her. Okay, that is not just I have been a bit rude. And when you say he apologised, he did not even recognise his abhorrent, disgusting, frightening racism. He said he had just been a bit rude. He would not even accept that. And if you are going to be preaching to the country about extremism, you have to put your money literally where your mouth is. This guy is a disgusting racist. He is bankrolling the Conservative Party. Will you give that money back?
The comments were clearly racist, they were clearly abhorrent, they were clearly wrongly. I don't know why anyone would want to morally compromise themselves so much by defending it. But for you, do you not see what this audience has said tonight? You've lost the legitimacy to tackle a really serious issue, which is extremism. Because these people and the people at home, they will not listen when you operate that double standard as a government. And you didn't come out as a government and say it was wrong. First of all, you said it was rude. Then you said it was racist. Then you said it was racist, but the money wasn't racist. And then you were saying that that you'd take more of the money. And now we find out you have. Of course it's wrong.
I guess the Prime Minister knows it's wrong,
but the fact is he's too weak. If you can't govern, you've got to call an election.
At the heart of all of this, with all the politicking going on, is a woman, and that woman is Diane Abbott. And I think what we forget is she is a human being like the rest of us. This woman was our first ever black elected woman into Parliament. In that time, she has been abused, humiliated, mocked, and now she's been threatened with death. And I do think, what does it say about our society that almost 40 years on, after the first ever black woman was elected, that we are in this cesspool of racism? I spoke to Diane this week, and what that woman has had to go through. So in the middle of all of this, yes, there's lots of accusations, but there is a human being at the heart of all of this, and her name is Diane Abbott.
I asked the question, why is Diane Abbott suspended from the Labour Party by Keir Starmer, who apparently did speak to her this week in the Commons. When she tried to speak in the Commons, I was talking to somebody earlier, they said she stood up 47 times to try and speak, and the Speaker did not call her at all.
Is this the Labour Friends of Israel Speaker?
That's that guy, yeah.
Lindsay Hoyle, yes. Whose father created the Labour Friends of Israel.
Yes, indeed, he didn't call her. I think all of this stuff is reprehensible, obviously, but it's not the Tory party. I've got a bit of a cheek coming out about extremism. Back in the 1940s, when the Irgun and the Haganah were killing police officers and soldiers, British police officers and soldiers, like the chap from the military police that we were hearing from earlier, we regarded the Israelis as terrorists. And of course, the descendants of those terrorists are the Israeli government now. Now, in the 1940s, nobody had any problem calling them terrorists and extremists. But of course, we don't call them terrorists and extremists now because they're a state and therefore they're okay. Even though they are, in fact, terrorists and extremists as they were in the 40s. So if we're going to start calling everybody, the only way this could possibly work is if the government was to be really, really even-handed. So they would have to say the right wing of the Tory party are clearly extremists, therefore they should get no public funding at all. And therefore, and we're also going to pick on supporters of Hamas. Hamas is an illegal structure in this country. It was made illegal some years ago.
The thing is that, for example, the genocide-supporting, far-right-supporting Labour Friends of Israel and Conservative Friends of Israel, they don't get funding here in the UK, they get it from Israel.
Yes, and of course...
And from America via Israel.
Yeah, so, I mean, this talk about extremism is because of panic in the establishment about the fact that most people in Britain do not support the Israeli attack on Gaza. They do not. And the political system doesn't recognise that because the Israelis have got a very powerful grip on the political system here, as they have in the United States and in other European countries. But they are extremists. In the 1940s, nobody had any question in their minds that they were extremists. They bombed the King David Hotel. They killed Lord Moyne. They killed the UN mediator, Bernadotte. And at that time, nobody had any doubt whatsoever that the Israelis were extremists. And that's how they got a state. What Hamas have done is copied the Israelis. And maybe the Hamas are extremists, but they are no more and no less extremists than the Israeli state itself. And perhaps the Israeli state, being an extremist state, should have boycotts, disinvestments and sanctions put on it, as the South Africans were. The South Africans had an extremist, right-wing, white supremacist government, and we did no aid, no trade, and eventually we brought them down. That's what they should be talking about. But they're not.
So... the reason that Diane Abbott is suspended, and maybe you could say what you think about this, Martin, in a letter to The Observer in April 2023, she responded to an article by Tomiwa Awolade titled "Racism in Britain is not a black and white issue. It's far more complicated." Miss Abbott said, Awolade claims that Irish, Jewish and traveller people all suffer from racism. They undoubtedly experience prejudice. This is similar to racism and the two words are often used as if they're interchangeable. It's true that many types of white people with points of difference, such as redheads, can experience this prejudice too, but they are not all their lives subject to racism. In pre-civil rights America, Irish people, Jewish people and travellers were not required to sit at the back of the bus. So what she's doing, she's saying actually that the black racism, in fact she goes on to say, in apartheid South Africa these groups were allowed to vote and in the height of slavery there were no white seeming people manacled on the slave ships. In response to the Labour Party withdrew the party whip on the deeply offensive and wrong comments. So what was deeply offensive and wrong about saying that?
Well, I think what's going on here is an argument about the definition of words. Yeah? What is racism? What is race? Because in actual fact, it's not easy to define.
She's talking here, I suppose, about a hierarchy of evil or hierarchy of racism, a hierarchy of prejudice. And she's saying that actually, you know, it's not really a good idea to be comparing people having a go at redheads with people having a go at West Indians, for example,
well,
black
she,
people.
I understand that she apologised for what she'd said, but in if we had a more interrogative culture, we would allow people to say things and then say, well, I don't actually agree with that for whatever reason.
Is this suspension anything to do with Gaza and Palestine?
Of course it is. Underlying all of, and also, of course, to get rid of the campaign group of Labour MPs. Keir Starmer's policy has been to get them out of the party, although he's now finding it a bit difficult. And, of course, the Tories have always hated these people for all the reasons that we know, which is why this guy, in his private meeting with his employees, thought that he could just get away with this casual sort of remark. But, of course, somebody must have recorded it. People need to think about these things these days.
Yeah, from years
they?
Ago, maybe MI5 had been sitting on that.
Sorry?
Maybe MI5 had been sitting on that recording. Who?
Well, it was
somebody.
It was
The
Guardian who had it. So it may be...
Well, it depends who they gave it to, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
But
in any case, you need
them.
To think about these things, don't you? I mean, we're on air now, and anything we say is on the record forever. And if you're in a meeting in your company, you know, selling stuff to the NHS because you're a Tory donor, and that's the question that's in my mind. How did he get the contract for the IT for the NHS? Has it anything to do with the 15 million? Or not?
Well, what about the guy in Stroud, Steve, I can't remember his surname, that got a massive contract really early on. He happened to be the master of one of the top Freemasons lodges in Stroud. And he got that contract. He sold his house and bought a farm. And he's still there in the Daily Mail from time to time, have a little pop at him saying, you got all this from PPE. How did you get that contract? So, maybe this Hester guy is a Freemason too, and he's somehow in the loop there.
Well, I think that's what
might
people
be,
are missing
it
about
might be,
this.
It might be simply that, this is why he gives so much money to the Tory party. It's because most of the money he makes is coming from dodgy government contracts.
Exactly. And that's not really been picked up by anybody else, and that's why people listen to this show.
Okay, well, anyway, on extremism, there were some sensible voices, even though the Israel lobby and the Speaker of the House of Commons denied Diane Abbott the right to speak on Wednesday. There was someone that was allowed to speak yesterday, Thursday, and on the Michael Gove extremism debate, and that was the new MP for Rochdale, George Galloway.
George Galloway.
Deputy Speaker, it's quite clear that there's a shared endeavour going on between the two front benches, but as questions have continued, it's quite clear there's unease on both sides of the House on the back benches, and for very good reasons. It is obviously true that this is part of a culture war wallpaper that's being created for the general election soon to come. It's not good enough to say that it doesn't seek to ban or jail anyone. You try getting a bank account once you've been branded by Michael Gove as an extremist. Now, extremism, if we were debating this in the Oxford Union, as once we did in his salad days on another matter, we'd all be talking about what's the definition. I just remind the Secretary that a former Speaker of this House was wearing a Hang Nelson Mandela T-shirt when my right honourable friend and I were seeking the overthrow of apartheid and being called divisive. This building is designed to show that politics is full of division, and sometimes those reviled as extremists turn out to have been right all along.
Can I first of all congratulate the Honourable Member on his election as Member of Parliament for Rochdale? As he quite rightly points out, we have known each other for several decades, and during that time I have always admired his oratorical skills and the passion with which he makes his case. There's nothing in this definition that any Honourable Member should fear from will inhibit them from making their case, and while I passionately disagree with the Honourable Gentleman on so many issues, he has the same rights as every other member of this House and deserves to be listened to with respect as he makes his case.
So, George Galloway bringing up the sort of spectre of Nelson Mandela, obviously in the background hovering around, is the peace agreement with the IRA. So you may be having an extremist right now, but that's the person you will need to talk to and negotiate with if you're going to have peace in the future.
Well, we're arguing about the definition of words here, aren't we? one person's extremist is somebody else's freedom fighter. That's always been the case. Yeah. I mean, the terrorists that set up the state of Israel, the Irgun and the Haganah and the Lehi, they were extremists, but they got a state out of it. And having got a state, they then become moderates in people's minds. And just goes to show that in actual fact, it's politics as usual. You accuse your enemies of being whatever, and your friends are given a bye. And that's been the way of it forever.
And it is, and I find it fascinating that the discussion, domestic discussion about extremism is closely linked to the poison pouring into the UK through Downing Street and through the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Defence because of the support for the Israelis in Gaza. So we go back to BBC's question time last night where this was picked up on again. Just to let you know who it was speaking for the government, it was Lee Rowley, MP, Minister of Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities. That's the local government minister. Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Lee Rowley. And then there was Jonathan Reynolds, MP, Labour's Shadow Business and Trade Secretary, SNP's Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, MP, and also the broadcaster, Aisha Masrilka, who was an advisor to the Labour Party. And finally, as we're going to hear from now, the Daily Mail columnist, I think she's still a columnist, I'm not sure, Melanie Phillips. Just before we hear the clip from Question Time, we're going to hear just a little clip from the protest outside, because it was in Liverpool. As you'd expect, the people of Liverpool were there outside Question Time protesting, in this case, about Gaza.
7th on October the 7th have rightly been condemned by all political parties. They were utterly abhorrent. And the hostages who still remain in control, who are still under the control of Hamas, must be released. But my colleagues and I have been consistent since the weeks following that we need to have an immediate ceasefire. And the reason for that is simple, is that the people of Palestine are being collectively punished for the actions of a terrorist group. They are being denied access to water, to food, to medicine, to electricity, to the ability to leave. And meantime, they are being indiscriminately shot and bombed. 70,000 men, women and children injured. 30,000 men, women and children dead. And I have been utterly ashamed to be a member of the Westminster Parliament as it has sat for months in silence, instead of calling for that immediate ceasefire. And two things need to happen now. We finally dragged the Labour Party to a position where it backs a ceasefire, and hopefully we can get the government to do likewise. But meantime, we need to end arms sales to Israel, and we need to use our voice, the UK's voice, as a permanent member of the UN Security Council to advocate immediately for a ceasefire. No ifs, no buts.
And let me just ask you, Stephen, when you say no ifs, no buts, and you've become completely clear at the SNP that you want an immediate ceasefire, and as you say, you've called for that consistently, how do you get the hostages released?
Nothing would please me more than to see the hostages.
But the ceasefire is not conditioned upon that you're calling for, is it?
No, because there is no justification for bombing, targeting and collectively punishing a civilian population for the actions of a terrorist group.
Okay.
And what needs to happen is there needs to be an end to fighting, there needs to be an immediate discussion. We need to see the UK and the US show some backbone, stand up to Benjamin Netanyahu and get this sorted.
So it's have the ceasefire, as you say, and then hope
and somehow the hostages get released.
And then use the voice that we have collectively across the world to advocate for making sure those hostages are released. Absolutely.
Menon. I live mainly in Israel. I come here a great deal. I am British. I will always be British. And it is a tragedy beyond measure that so many decent people, well-meaning people in Britain, have got this completely the wrong way around. What's happening in Gaza is indeed a tragedy. War is terrible. Civilians are killed. But what Stephen has just said is so distorted and so untrue. Let me just take you to one or two points that he has said.
That's cool.
He says that the Gazans are being denied by Israel access to food and humanitarian supplies.
Yes.
This is completely untrue. There have been hundreds and hundreds of trucks going through Gaza. There have been hundreds of trucks stopped by going from going through Gaza because the food is being stolen by Hamas. The Gazans themselves are saying this. You laugh because you don't know. I am telling you.
But hang on. Melanie, in fairness, the UN says that not enough trucks are being allowed in and that children are dying of starvation. You've got UNICEF saying children are dying of starvation.
The UN has had its own operatives in UNRWA, the Relief and Welfare Organization, who are members of Hamas, dozens and dozens of them. Yeah. They are entirely compromised.
Okay, so just a minute, I'll let you speak, I promise. But just to be clear what you're saying, when you've got the WHO and the UN and the EU humanitarian chief saying there is famine in Gaza, you're saying that's not true.
You can go on YouTube and see pictures of the stocked food markets in Gaza. Why are you laughing? Have you seen these video pictures?
I have looked at some of them. They don't have timestamps on them. I've got to point that out. So I don't know when these pictures were taken.
Okay.
I mean, if you have proof that they were taken in the last October.
If you want to look at pictures, Melanie, I'm quite happy to send you some pictures and videos of civilians being bombed and slaughtered.
Let's let Melanie make
I'll send you some videos.
If you want to talk about slaughter, Stephen, you accuse Israel of indulging in collective punishment. You don't understand, I'm afraid. Well-meaning people here have no idea what it's like to be in Israel. Not only is it a very small country, there is virtually not a single household that is not personally touched by this. Either they've had family or friends murdered on October 7th, they are being taken hostage, their boys and girls, their grandchildren, children are on the front line and they are dying every day. There are rockets, hundreds of rockets every day coming from the north, from the Hezbollah.
Okay, Melanie, you're making your points very powerfully. I'm just going to, because you've made some accusations against Stephen, I want to let him answer.
You know what? Those weren't accusations. Those were outrageous, disgusting slurs, and I actually feel quite sorry.
We heard what you said.
However.
Okay, let him answer.
Yeah, well, he goes on to say, I just hope one day you realise just how bad things are over in Gaza. But anyway, good old fiery question time. And it's actually quite refreshing to hear not only a bit of a broad spread of opinion on the panel on these issues, such as extremism and Gaza, but also the contributions from the floor as well. Some very good ones. But anyway, Martin, this is, Melanie Phillips there saying all sorts of, you could say interesting things about what's going on with the aid convoys being sabotaged and the food stolen by Hamas?
Well, it's a sort of fantasy world. I mean, Melanie Phillips has lived in a fantasy world for many, many years. When she first started writing for The Guardian, I used to read her back in those days, and you gradually realise, no, this person is absolutely, she's one sandwich short of a picnic, as they say in Liverpool. I mean, how you can go on to argue that there is no starvation, and if there is, it's because Hamas has stolen the food. I mean, it's just so out of line with what everybody is seeing on their social media feeds. Now, in the past, of course, before we had the internet, the Israeli line on what was happening probably would have been backed up by the various international news organisations, and she might have been able to get away with it. But as, you know, Flynn points out there, you know, everybody, especially younger people, are getting all of their information from their social media.
Well, I think it was pretty clear amongst the audience. So they don't believe a word she's saying.
That's right. Well, don't forget this.
There's one person clapped when she said that, very, very fiercely, trying to make it sound like they were like four or five people, but one person in the entire audience. And it was, it's basically Flynn manages to turn things around and just put them on Melanie Phillips, saying, oh, well, you know, if you want to see pictures, I can show you pictures of, you know, dying kids. And we hope next week, by the way, to have an interview with, I shouldn't tempt fate, but with a Bristol doctor that's been working in Gaza, actually emergency doctor, so hoping to have a direct interview with him. But these sorts of things are, I mean, it's a hideous kind of poison that pours from people like Melanie Phillips, where she's making these sorts of accusations when actually a genocide is going on. It's not a war, it's a massacre, a slaughter, and the people can't get out.
Well, I'm going to stick my neck out here and point out that in actual fact it is a war. Hamas is the elected government of Palestine. They shouldn't possibly have taken civilian hostages. No problem with military hostages, and many of them are in fact military. They are prisoners of war. Don't forget the Israelis are holding hundreds of Palestinians with no charge or trial. Yeah. Marwan Barghouti, who is there, Nelson Mandela, we mentioned Nelson Mandela, he's been in prison for years for doing nothing at all apart from being a potential leader of the Palestinians. And that's totally missing from Melanie's analysis. And of course, the other thing is, what actually happened on October the 7th? It looks like, and we've been discussing this in previous weeks, the Israeli intelligence services allowed Hamas to do what they did, because they wanted to set up a possibility of massacring the Palestinians, which is exactly what the Labour candidate in Rochdale said, and then was removed from the ballot, but removed from the contest, effectively.
There is a dividing line around the world about this, because people in Lebanon and Syria believe that too. They believe the Israelis knew it was going to happen.
That's right. I mean,
and they deliberately allowed it to happen in order to give them an excuse
and
to
also,
go into Gaza.
Also, around the world, people recognise that Hamas is the elected government of Palestine, just as I recognise that Likud is the elected government of Israel. Now, we could say that Likud are extremists, and therefore we shouldn't recognise them at all. No negotiations, no discussions with them. In actual fact, we could say, like with Serbia and Slobodan Milosevic, maybe we should go to war with them. And instead of the RAF bombing Yemen from Akrotiri, we could be bombing Israel. We could knock out their air bases. That's what we'd have done in the 1940s if they had air bases, because don't forget, they were killing our soldiers and police officers, shooting them in the back.
They even
and killing civilians.
By the way, the Zionists even threatened to assassinate Winston Churchill.
They did indeed. Winston Churchill was very pro-Zionist, but even he lost faith with them after they assassinated Lord Moyne, his personal friend. And they were extremists. Do you know what? They're still extremists. Melanie Phillips is an extremist. She should be banned, shouldn't she? I don't think she should be banned. We should listen to her. I think we should listen to everybody. But she is an extremist.
Well, one person we're not allowed to listen to is George Galloway when he's being interviewed on RT. And here he is last week speaking about Gaza.
Well, first of all, a ceasefire is necessary but woefully insufficient. As you rightly say, I've been in this cause since the 1970s. That's a long time by anybody's reckoning. And I have seen more ceasefires than I could possibly count. A ceasefire, particularly a Kamala Harris ceasefire for 6 weeks, is merely the precursor to a resumption of violence on both sides. It's merely a precursor to more slaughter on both sides. And so, whilst of course I support a ceasefire, that is not nearly enough. There must be a ceasefire. There must be a complete withdrawal of occupation forces from Gaza, which I remind you is internationally recognized illegally occupied territory. Israel has no right to be there legally. And following on from that withdrawal, then we can have an all-for-all exchange of hostages, prisoners, call them what you will. There are thousands and thousands of Palestinian hostages or prisoners, depending on how you want to describe them. And then there has to be, as President Putin himself said many times during this crisis, there has to be an immediate, and I mean immediate, establishment of a Palestinian state I supported the Oslo Agreement, but I've been supporting it for more than 30 years. Where is it? Where is the so-called two-state solution? Now, if we don't get that, then another prison breakout from Gaza is guaranteed, and more bloodshed on both sides is guaranteed. And we'll all be back having this conversation all over again.
Well, I obviously agree with George's analysis there. I'm increasingly of the view that a two-state solution is impossible and that the state of Israel is going to have to go the way of Algérie Française. It's just going to have to stop existing. There's going to be one state. It's going to be called Palestine. Jews will be allowed to live there, but they won't dominate it. And those who can't stand that will have to, like Melanie, will have to come back and live in Britain where she was born. Yeah, because it won't be the place for her.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu will then be famous for having destroyed his own country.
Well, many on the left in Israel, of Israeli politics, think that's exactly what he's doing.
The thing is, there are not many.
Ehud Olmert is a former Labour Prime Minister of Israel.
There's a few.
Saying pretty much that. But we're moving on from this now. The 67 borders of Israel are not legitimate, in my view. Even the 48 borders are open to question because no local forces agreed to those 48 borders. It was imposed by the US and the Soviet Union. No locals were consulted. And so, you know, we've got to rewind the video all the way back. Maybe there shouldn't be a state of Israel at all. And that's not racist nor anti-Semitic. There is, Kosovo is now independent of Serbia. Algeria does no longer belong to France. That's what happens in World Wars.
This is not just Martin Summers saying this. The week before last, at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, here's one of South Africa's lawyers saying pretty much the same thing.
Israel's statehood was recognised and Israel admitted as a UN member despite this illegality. Israel is not the legal continuation or successor of the mandate. This violation of Palestinian self-determination is ongoing and unresolved. Two key elements are, first, Palestinian people not displaced from the land proclaimed to be of Israel in 48 and their descendants have been forced to live as citizens. Presently, they constitute 17.2% of a state conceived to be of and for another racial group, under the domination of that group, necessarily treated as second class because of their race. Second, Palestinian people displaced from that land and their descendants cannot return. These are serious breaches of the right of self-determination, the prohibitions of racial discrimination and apartheid, and the right of return. They must end immediately. As if this ongoing Nakba was not catastrophic enough, in 1967, Israel captured the remaining 22% of historic Palestine, the Gaza Strip and West Bank, including East Jerusalem. The Naxa. It's maintained that use of force to remain in control for the 57-year period since. For more than half a century then, a state defined to be of and for Jewish people exclusively has governed the entire land of historic Palestine and the Palestinian people there. And the regime of racial domination, apartheid, and denying return has been extended throughout.
So, I'm not sure of the lawyer's name, but anyway, he's acting for the South Africans in The Hague and the International Court of Justice. But he's making some pretty important points. He's saying, I suppose, if in effect, that it's 60 years since the West Bank and Gaza were captured by the Israelis, and the Israelis are shrugging their shoulders now and saying, well, it's kind of ours now, really, isn't it? Even though under international law it's not, they don't care.
Well, they don't care, quite clearly, but under international law it doesn't belong to them. The only reason why the 67 borders have been accepted by the international community was on the basis of the Oslo Agreement, which there would be a Palestinian state. Now, in the initial UN resolution in 1948 or 47, whenever it was, there was supposed to be two states created, one Israeli Jewish and one Palestinian. They were both supposed to be created simultaneously. But the Israeli extremists, because they were extremists, immediately went to war against the British and against the Palestinians so that they could get the biggest chunk of territory they could seize through main force, which included killing lots and lots of civilians at Deir Yassin. And the reason why the Palestinians fled is because they were being massacred. That's why they fled. And of course, that's not an acceptable way to create a state. And since then, we've all gone through, well, they're there now. We'll have to find some kind of way of dealing with them, so and so and so forth. And of course, over time, people get used to, well, they're there now. What can you do? But ultimately, they've got to play ball themselves with the deals that they claim to have made. And if they don't stick to those deals, then those deals are off the table. If you do not want a two-state solution, Netanyahu has made it clean he does not, then in that case, the two-state solution comes off the table. That means only one state, and that state must be Palestine. And if they think they can win a world war, they're deluded. It's a small country, as Melanie Phillips says. The Russian Air Force are in Syria. If the Russian Air Force had to take on the Israeli Air Force and the British Air Force in Akrotiri and the US Air Force in the Mediterranean, they would win. That's the lesson of Ukraine. Ultimately, the Israeli state, if it carries on down this road, it will become a pariah, it will be sanctioned against, and ultimately it will be destroyed as a state. That doesn't mean the people, if they put their hands up and surrender, the army, you don't have to kill people. And, you know, if you put your hands up and surrender, we'll treat you as a prisoner of war. But the state itself is going to have to go. And that's an extreme position by me. I recognise that. It's not in the mainstream. But on the other hand, it's a legitimate position. I may be in a minority in that position, but it's an absolutely legitimate position. And if you don't agree with me, you've got to make an argument about it.
Well,
you
actually, can't just tell there, me to shut up. Aren't there quite a few states, particularly Middle Eastern states, that would say, yes, you're right.
Well, that's right.
Israel has not actually reached the bar of proving itself to be a proper democracy in a civilised country to enable us to send an ambassador and to offer them statehood.
That's right.
From our point of
view. That's right. And, of course, Hamas's position is we are not going to recognise you until you recognise us. I mean, why should we... But Hamas doesn't recognise the existence of Israel. Why the hell should Hamas recognise the existence of Israel? It's for Israel to persuade Hamas to recognise them. Hamas are under no obligation to recognise them whatsoever. They are the elected government of Palestine.
Some of the latest, just literally the last couple of days, we've seen Senator Chuck Schumer saying that Benjamin Netanyahu is now an obstacle for peace, and he calls for Israeli elections. The Likud party said in response that Chuck Schumer shouldn't be undermining the Israeli government. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, slammed Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu as an obstacle to peace, called for new elections. A lifelong supporter of Israel, it's become clear to me, he said, the Netanyahu coalition no longer fits the needs of Israel after the 7th of October. The world has changed radically. The Israeli people are being stifled right now by a governing vision that is stuck in the past, Schumer said in a speech on the Senate floor.
Well, another interesting development was that Benny Gantz, who was the opposition to Netanyahu, he was invited to the US to talk with Blinken and other top US officials, which is against the protocol, because he's actually, you know, he's in the coalition government now, which was formed after the October the 7th event. But he shouldn't necessarily be invited to speak to top officials, you know, cutting Netanyahu out. But what he told the American officials was, even if I was elected, I would still pursue the same policy as Netanyahu. And in actual fact, there is clearly a majority in Israel for the extinction of any idea of a Palestinian state, and some people are openly calling for the massacre of Palestinians. At this point, you cut off all aid and trade, and I would suggest, given my experiences in Bosnia and in Yugoslavia, at some point you go to war with them, as we did with Serbia. And of course, people say, well, we can't go to war with Israel. Well, we've been to war with Libya, we've been to war with Serbia, we've been to war with Syria, effectively. We've been to war with Iraq. We've been to war with Afghanistan. Why can't we go to war with Israel? Why not?
At least 20 Palestinians were killed and over 100 wounded by the Israeli forces on Thursday evening whilst they were awaiting aid in northern Gaza. Eyewitnesses have said the Palestinian Health Ministry said 20 dead bodies and 155 wounded have arrived at Al-Shifa Hospital in northern Gaza. It said that it is working to retrieve more dead bodies. The ministry added it expects the death toll to rise because of the seriousness of the injuries individuals reaching Gaza's hospitals. Journalists with Al Jazeera Arabic reported that nearly 50 Palestinians were killed. Several news outlets also reported dozens more were wounded. Middle East Eye could not independently verify the figures. The attack took place when an Israeli helicopter fired on a crowd of thousands of Palestinians waiting for aid at the Q8 roundabout in Gaza City. So, Martin, this sounds pretty horrific, doesn't it? But this is the way it was reported by the BBC this morning.
The Israeli military has denied that its forces opened fire on crowds waiting for aid lorries in Gaza City, calling the accusation a smear campaign. The Hamas-run health ministry says that at least 20 people were killed and many more wounded by Israeli troops. Our correspondent, Anna Foster, reports from Jerusalem.
The Israel Defense Forces said their intensive preliminary review of the killings showed no tank, aircraft or gunfire had come from their troops. They said Palestinian gunmen were responsible for the attack on the aid convoy at the Q8 roundabout in Gaza City. The humanitarian situation in Gaza remains dire as the first shipment of supplies to arrive by sea nears the territory's coastline. A temporary jetty has been built in the north of Gaza to receive it, but the next challenge will be securely and fairly distributing the aid to a desperate population. As international pressure for a humanitarian ceasefire continues, Israel's war and security cabinets are meeting to discuss Hamas's latest proposals to mediators. The Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said they contained unrealistic demands. But it shows that lines of communication are still open as Egyptian and Qatari negotiators press for an agreement between the two sides.
So that's the BBC's Anna Foster there doing a little report, but saying, always using words like, oh, this is the Hamas information. Hamas say that the Israelis did this, the Israelis say the opposite. So what do you think happened?
Well, I think it's probably the same as various other incidents of a similar kind that have gone on. It's a part of a pattern, isn't it? And I also note that the British have stopped dropping aid into Gaza because they killed five Palestinians by accident. And this whole idea of bringing stuff in by sea, it's not going to do anything in the short run. And of course, there used to be a port in Gaza, but the Israelis closed it down. Are the Israeli military going to control the aid that's coming in by sea? Or are the SAS going to shoot them up as they bring the aid ashore and the Israelis try to stop them? Maybe the British military can then shoot the Israelis up and distribute the aid. And if we're going to do that, why don't we just go to war with Israel like we did with Serbia? Yeah, it's a matter of principle, Tony.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just find it interesting that the BBC can lead with just a denial that we've got anything to do with this from the Israelis, rather than to do a report explaining that the Israelis have killed these people. I mean, they're creating hell there, aren't they? They're making starving people, and then when the aid is coming in, as the people come to collect that aid, that's a way to get them out of the houses, out of the burnt buildings and things, and they're out in the open, they kill them.
That's right. And of course, we've also got many, many Israeli soldiers on their social media feeds showing them abusing civilians, killing them and shooting them. There's evidence that they've been carrying out torture and rape. This is, and of course, at the same time, they're pretending, yes, but we didn't do it. Hamas killed their own people there, Tony. It's obvious. Hamas just waited for these people to come out of of their houses to collect the aid, and Hamas killed their own people to make Israel look bad. That's the obvious thing that you've got to say. And I'm sure that's what Melanie Phillips would say.
Well, here in Bristol, doing our bit to protest these things in various ways, there was an arms fair last weekend at Ashton Gate, which is Bristol City football ground. And, of course, being Bristol, a bit like Liverpool, there's a big crowd of people outside making sure that the voices against this genocide were heard.
I'm absolutely disgusted with the Ashton Gate people here that have allowed this awful thing to happen.
Yeah. I live locally, this is my local football ground, and I really object to it being used for arms trade, and I object to the arms trade entirely, particularly at the moment Elbit Systems, which is an Israeli-owned company, operating here. And Britain is selling arms and has been selling arms to Israel for an extremely long time, when it was absolutely obvious the sort of thing that they would do with them.
Devastated, I'm outraged, I'm furious, I'm desperately, desperately sad, because I've got quite a few connections with teachers in Gaza. My background was in education. The messages I've been sending her in Gaza are now no longer being delivered or read, and I fear the worst. It's hard to know how to kind of process information like that, people that I've known for a a couple of years. Students have been killed from the online class that I taught. And the world seems largely indifferent. Not people, but the leaders, the people who could actually change things.
I do not know how people sleep at night because they're bombing Palestine. It's disgusting. It just makes me cry. I stay up at night and I just can't sleep. Every time I hear fireworks or anything, it's like a bomb's going off.
And what? Palestine is what we know about, isn't it? Because we see it on the news. But it has been going on all over the world. And it's getting worse because the arms are getting more sophisticated. And I don't think people quite realise what they're involved in.
I don't know how anyone isn't protesting it. It's not a war. There's no war that kills civilians en masse at this level of 30,000 people in 5 months. I hope that this might be the last arms fair here in Bristol, because Bristol has a very strong link with Palestine. You've got the museum here, you've got a very active Palestine solidarity campaign, and I hope that this protest today will send a very clear message to the organisers that it's just not worth holding an event like this in Bristol, because we don't want it here, we really don't.
So that's Ashton Gate last weekend, Martin. Very active protest going on here in Bristol against the arms industry. And of course, we have also had activities against the Elbit arms firm making these drones and various other military equipment for the Israelis. And in fact, it's an Israeli company, which is finds it more convenient to base itself here in Britain than over in Israel. And so maybe they're extremists, but the protesters have been doing things like breaking into the buildings and also doing things like covering the entire building in red paint and shutting them down.
That's right. And of course, I'll just get this plug in now. Tomorrow, there is a demonstration in Bristol. It's in memory of the dead in Gaza. So they're asking people to turn up in black and bring in flowers. It's going to assemble at 12 p.m. at Castle Park bandstand tomorrow and marched to Castle Park, to College Green. So I'll just get that one in as a plug before we move any further, because it's just on the top of my mind. Yeah, I mean, it's Elbit Systems have got a factory and a new factory up in Filton. I know, and in fact, Bristol, as we know, has actually a rather intimate relationship to the arms industry.
Well, Filton likes to brag, as does Bradley Stoke, and these kind of Aztec West-type areas up in the north-west of the city, as high-tech, and this is the future.
Yes, high-tech weaponry. And, of course, you know, you sometimes think where people are making a living producing weaponry like that, and they're probably making a good living, you think, well, you know, somebody is going to resent that, aren't they? Are they going to resent it enough to perhaps come and do something about it? You need to think about these things.
Well, one person that stood against all this sort of thing was, I mentioned him, I think you mentioned him actually, Martin, briefly last week, was the former Foreign Secretary for the Labour Party, Robin Cook. Do you want to just say a little bit about who he was? Yeah, you could find his famous speech up online, which is a pathetic thing to say, really. Sorry, folks, but rather than listen to it now, it's a terrific speech. But he was a very principled chap, and he resigned, didn't he, just before the Iraq War?
That's right. He wrote a book called, I can't remember what the book was called now, The End of the Line or something like that. And, of course, he resigned from the Labour government just before the Iraq War because he couldn't go along with it. And
he got a round of applause.
He wasn't Foreign Secretary at the time. I think he was Leader of the House. But he just resigned from the government. And, of course, he then subsequently had a very mysterious death on the side of a
mountain
in Scotland.
Yes, he did, 2 years later. Actually, it's not the only person to there be questions about whether these political leaders of various sorts have been assassinated to get them out of the way. Robin Cook, of course, is one. And I'll put a list up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Maybe you can give your opinion on some of these, Martin. January 1963, Hugh Gaitskill died, age 56. He was in opposition to the 1957 Treaty of Rome, the nascent European Economic Community, and he was replaced by the pro-EEC George Brown. Any hint of possible assassination there, do you think?
I think unlikely in that case, but who knows?
Yeah, because he's pro-EU or anti-EU, and you're pro-EU. No?
Well, possibly, well, yes, but Union. I mean, it's not the sort of issue.
This is the United States of Europe. It's a very serious issue. At that time, they didn't want a Labour leader who was totally against it.
Well, Gateskill, I can't remember whether Gateskill was against it or for it.
He was against it. Definitely, okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, don't forget, Harold Wilson wasn't necessarily against it or for it. It wasn't actually such a big issue in those days as it subsequently became. Now, listen, if you're thinking that the Eurocrats kill politicians in Britain, it's the Yanks that kill politicians
both,
in this country.
Or maybe both.
Ah.
Anyway,
so are the Yanks and the Eurocrats on the same side or not?
Maybe they are. Maybe, May 1994, John Smith died. Do you know how old he was?
50-something.
55 years old. He died in the Barbican. Very strange. People have suggested that it was an induced heart attack. I remember speaking to a photographer who was actually there at the time, and he said actually a lot of the journalists were in tears because he'd been such a brilliant orator. He's one of those people that made a terrible, terrible mess of, I think it was John Major, wasn't it, at the time. Very, very good at thinking on his feet. He was also wanting to do things like renationalise. This wasn't very popular amongst the oligarchy, and tax the rich. He wanted to make sure that the Labour Party, when it came in 1997, would have been taxing rich people. He was very close to Brian Gould, who was, I think he was Labour spokesman, maybe a shadow chancellor or something, Gould. Mm. And after the death of Smith, that was really it for Brian Gould. He went back to New Zealand and sort of retired over there.
Well, no, Gould effectively said that he resigned from frontline politics in Britain because Smith went on the prawn cocktail offensive in the city. What Smith had also done, he spoke at the Socialist International in Geneva 2 weeks before he died. I got hold of his speech and I used it in my book, which came out in 1998, where he said, we're going to have to abolish the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Yeah, well, that's another reason.
That's a red rag to a political
association, assassination. Leader of the Labour Party, John Smith, May 1994.
Does Keir Starmer want to abolish the IMF, do you think?
Age 55. September 1997, Royal Princess Diana, a car accident, Dodi Al Fayed. Main reasons for that are most likely to do with landmines, to do with Dodi Al Fayed and her announcing their engagement, her potentially being pregnant, likely being pregnant, at least that's what I've been told by someone very close inside. I mean, we were hearing, was it last week, I think, about Richard Tomlinson saying that this method of assassination, he'd seen them, plans to do this sort of thing with a flash in a tunnel and a car crash to kill Slobodan Milosevic. That was there sitting on the shelf as a assassination plan at MI6, according to Tomlinson. And also, yes, this idea of the Muslim half-brothers and sisters to William and Harry. This didn't go down very well. What do you make of that one, Martin?
Well, I think she probably was assassinated. Now, the problem with this list of assassinations that you're running through is I've got a list in my mind of people who've been assassinated,
yeah.
Which is not necessarily your list.
No, well, fine, please. You know, you can add if you want. I'm trying to go through chronologically.
Michael Hastings in the US.
Yeah? Oh, yeah, he's definitely...
Yeah, who was investigating... what was his name? McChrystal, who is the head of the US military in Afghanistan. Cathy McCarthy, who was killed in Northern Ireland when she was a young Sinn Féin activist, aged 23, shot dead in a university bar in Belfast, in Queen's University in Belfast, could have been a president of Ireland.
I mean, the other thing
she was assassinated
Al Fayed
by the state.
Mohammed Al Fayed, Dodi's father, was the funder of Scallywag magazine in London in the 1990s, and that was doing a better job, really, at winkling out political stories and was much more prepared to face the risk of libel cases than was Private Eye. Private Eye had become a bit weak and rather useless and rather too pro-establishment for many people's likings, and those journalists all got together around a guy called Simon Regan, former News of the World investigative journalist, to do a magazine. So I suppose the royal family are thinking, good God, you know, we don't really want Mohammed Al Fayed funding a magazine which is going to be you know, kind of pro-Diana, pro-Dodi, and anti-Charles, anti-Camilla. And so, and John, I mean, there's Noel Botham's book, but probably the best is John Morgan's book, How They Murdered Princess Diana, The Shocking Truth, which has got all the evidence in there from the police inquiries, both in the UK and in France, as well as the inquest, transcripts from the inquest, which show that in all likelihood it was MI6 and the royals that got together, something called the Way Ahead Group, to decide, well, we're going to have to, yes, press the button. And it was Sherard Cowper-Coles, who was a director of BAE Systems, also took over as the Paris station of MI6 chief a few weeks before. And then once the assassination is completed, he then disappeared. So all sorts of information in those John Morgan books. A really short version is the Paris-London connection about the Diana assassination in September 1997. Going forward a couple of years to the 26th of April 1999, Jill Dando, contract killing over handing a list of BBC paedophiles to the Metropolitan Commissioner Sir Paul Condon. There was a chap called Barry George who was fitted up for that. What do you reckon about Dando? She used to be a presenter, didn't she, on Crime Watch?
Well, one of the things
she was collecting information about paedophiles in the BBC.
Yes, yeah, so one of the suggestions that was carried out by Serbian intelligence. Can I just mention Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister of Italy, who was kidnapped supposedly by the Red Brigades, and it turned out.
What year was this?
This is 1979.
Okay.
Now, we could, in actual fact, let's just make this clear. The state in the West, the deep state, does indeed assassinate people. Nobody in West Belfast would doubt that for a moment. That's what goes on. And no doubt we're going to be coming to discuss the Russian situation
later.
In a
minute, yeah.
And people will be going on about people assassinated in Russia. Now, assassination is, in fact, one of them. You know, it goes on all the time. The Israelis boast about the people they assassinate. Rise Up and Kill First, the book, is all about how they killed
Ronan Bergman. Yeah,
that's right. So the idea that there is no such thing as political assassination is strictly for the birds. But each individual assassination or murder, let's call it what it is, has a specific, the police know that they're dealing with murders. But each murder is specific. Yeah. There's usually specific motives.
Well, the police don't look into these sorts. The police don't really look into these sorts of murders. For example, it was the Royal Coroner that did the inquest into Diana's death, and the police are just shoved aside. Boris Berezovsky is another one. Yeah, the police are just shoved aside by the security services. They say, out the way, please, it's national security involved.
Yes, Berezovsky died in Surrey, I can't remember when, not that long ago, a few years ago now, and the coroner refused to sign it off as suicide. He supposedly hanged himself in his own toilet while his security team had gone off to the pub or whatever, and his daughter never accepted that he'd been committed suicide. The coroner accepted the daughter's.
I mean, up until the 1990s, these sorts of scenarios, faking as someone's suicide, and various ways of killing people, were just they were on the TV the whole time. You would see a film about this kind of thing, a drama series, whether it's I don't know, the Avengers or these kinds of programs, all sorts of them. Where these sorts of things were discussed, but nowadays, I don't know, we've got to be a little bit careful about that sort of thing.
In the Berezovsky case, what's interesting is you'd have thought somebody who was a noted critic of Putin, who supposedly committed suicide, you'd have thought they'd have gone to town on that. He's been killed by the Russians. But of course they didn't. They said, no, it's definitely suicide. That's what the local police said. Coroner wouldn't have it because he was assassinated by the British. Not by the Russians. What, we assassinate people too? Yes, we do.
Okay, another assassination, July 2003, Dr. David Kelly. They tried to fake his suicide because he exposed the Iraq war weapons of mass destruction lies. In fact, just as the war was kicking off, didn't he?
Well, it's obviously he also probably knew far too much about all sorts of things and was therefore in the frame for other things as well. As I say, we know the state carries out assassinations. We know, and nobody gets punished
okay,
for it.
Okay, another one is August 2010. It's Gareth Williams, a GCHQ worker. His body was left in a hold all in the bath in a safe house, an MI6 safe house in London. But as the Daily Mail revealed, he had pinched Bill Clinton's guest list from the National Security Agency for somebody, and this guest list was alleged to have been one of the links to Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell's parties. Well, so if he's pinched the list of those people, then
as we all know, Epstein committed suicide, except he didn't. Now, this list could get longer and longer.
Well, we've got two more to go.
Okay.
I mean, you can add some more.
Well,
if
I'm
you
adding
want,
some more in because otherwise we.
You're peppering some more in into
yes,
my
because people need
into
to get...
my assassination soup. Thank yeah. you. So June 2016, Jo Cox MP dies. She was shot and stabbed. It was blamed on a terrorist far right mental patient, Thomas Mayer. On the 16th of June, 8 days before the 24th of June, Brexit referendum. So there are implications there that maybe this was a mental patient who was manipulated to cause some sort of attack on this MP in order to sort of steer the media debate around, as we saw in 2017 with Jeremy Corbyn. And we're seeing, apparently, over the last week, there's been terrorist attacks in Russia in possibly an attempt to steer the media debate in Russia around Putin's presidential election.
Well, as Nigel Farage said on the evening of winning the referendum, and it was won without a shot being fired. But of course, a shot had been fired. Jo Cox had been killed by a homemade gun made by this guy. Now, I think
this use of mental patients, I think, has to be talked
about. Oh, it does happen.
Here.
It does happen, Tony. But I think you've got to be very careful. I don't think
we can't know one way or the other. No, all we can do is speculate.
Right.
Yeah.
If we're going to be serious about talking about things like Berezovsky and Moldo Moro and so on, we've got to be also. There are also random killings. They just are. You know, Jo Cox was killed. That Tory MP Furness, I can't remember his name was.
He, David Amos.
Amos. He was killed by a Muslim extremist. Yeah. But of course, the extremists in both those cases looked as if they were mad individuals. The shootings in the New Zealand mosque, which we're no doubt coming to later, that was supposedly a mad individual, probably connected to others. Same with Ben
Breivik. Well, I don't know how mad he was. He looked like a military person
to me.
So, in fact, many people have pointed out that the tactics that he used in the video that he shot on Facebook were special forces tactics, and various, you know, there were people dressed in red signalling to him.
You do get random killings by, for political reasons even. Do you know what I mean?
So you can manipulate someone, and also you can use a particularly evil special forces trained individual to do
yes,
these things.
Yes, you can. And underlying all of this is the use of terrorism by NATO intelligence services in particular. That is their stock in trade. It always has been. People think of the KGB and the FSB as being into assassination and so on. And of course, like most of these intelligence agencies, they were to some extent. But it's in the West, with its obsession with psychological warfare and the manipulation of public opinion, that this has become
an
epidemic.
Haven't they decided in the West that actually going to spend loads of money on this psychological warfare and not so much on things like tanks and infantry?
That's right. That's right. And of course, you didn't need to assassinate people in the Soviet Union. You could lock them up forever. You didn't need to kill them. Yeah? And in any case, nobody's got any power to try and change government policy by any kind of protest they might make. So there's not really much of an incentive to kill individuals. Whereas in the West, you have basically got an ostensibly democratic society, and you need to steer public opinion in the direction you want it to go, which is why the Red Brigade supposedly kidnapped Aldo Moro, and therefore led to this, through the strategy of tension, to the frustration of the Italian Communist Party from winning an election. There's a means, motive, and opportunity.
Our little list up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, as I will also be doing this. We're going to hear a bit of an interview now I did with Pastor Dia Moodley, because he was on, I was really quite quizzing him about, I think he's a Reformed Baptist ministry that he runs here in Bristol. And he, on a Saturday, goes down and preaches in the city centre on topics like migration sometimes, often on abortion, and various contentious topics, things that are supposed to be kind of settled arguments but aren't really. And he gets big crowds around him. Some of them are hostile, some of them are friendly. But anyway, I asked him how he thought he'd been exonerated, because the police have now said they overreacted when they told him that he couldn't preach on these topics here in Bristol City Centre out in the street.
Well, the latest is that they settled 1 week before we could go to court. So even some said police were making the claim. Well, Tony, it goes, I mean, I'll tell you in a nutshell. They were making the claim that not only am I not supposed to be talking to these people, one of the senior officers who is prepared to testify, he was making the claim that actually my biblical interpretation is not correct. So now the police officers have leaned over into biblical interpretation, into hermeneutics, they're now qualified to interpret what the Bible says. So this particular police officer, together with some other officers, were prepared to stand in court and say, dear Murli and his congregation have wrongly interpreted marriage, or have wrongly interpreted gender and sexuality, have wrongly interpreted the sanctity of life from the Bible. We believe, so when I say we believe, they believe that we'd got it totally wrong, and therefore biblical interpretation is important in the public square. I mean, they were prepared to make that ludicrous statement in court. Our lawyers challenged them, and so 1 week before the case could go to court, they contacted us and they offered us a settlement. So they settled the case on the fact that they said, well, we pushed for an apology, but that was hard to come. And so they said that if you read the article, and also on GB News, it was last week, that they said that their action toward me was disproportionate. So I had to settle for that word, disproportionate. And the downside for them is that they're now stuck with all the legal fees for both sides, which nobody in our city should be happy about, because where's this money coming from? It's taxpayers' money that they're paying. So we told them that don't do this, don't go down this road. But yet the constabulary, and I think the Freedom of Information would let us know, that this constabulary has taken on so many cases that they've lost, and they've wasted taxpayers' money because officers have dug their heels in and said they're right, and the person that they're contending with is wrong, like myself. And they're prepared to go all the way to prove it and find that, no, listen, they were wrong, and they've wasted their money.
Well, I think you'll find exactly the same with the city council. They keep losing court cases too. I've been involved in one myself where they were trying to exclude travellers, get an injunction to exclude travellers. And they would have spent many thousands of pounds on that pointless, well, we would thought was a pointless case. And lost. So, anyway, what do you think are the lessons here? If you take a step back from it all,
the lessons are very worrying. I think there's a lot of. I think we're going to see a lot more threat to freedom of speech. I think that the police, for me here in Bristol, are going to think. Well, they obviously think twice now before approaching me. We're still. Tony, we're still, Christians at the end of the day. I've gone back into the constabulary in January after the case was settled. I went back into the constabulary against all my Christian friends across the country saying to me, don't go back to work with them. I've gone back to work with them. I've met with the new chief inspector, and I said to them, here I am. This is who I am. I'm coming back to work with you. I said, you've just lost a case, but I don't think this is the end of the road for us. Let's do better. So I'm back to working with them, and they've been in contact with me. They want to work with me. They want to work with our congregation, and I think we could do well if we do work together. However, there are some people within the constabulary that still want to go down the same road that we went down previously, and we're learning how to deal with them. So the lesson here is, I think, we continue to communicate and make sure that we do better for Bristol. But I think the overarching worrying thing, not only for Bristol but across our nation, is that we're going to be more, and I want to put this most mildly, but hopefully get the point across. I think we're going to be more worried about what not to say about certain groups, because we're scared of how we're going to be interpreted, and we're scared that those people are going to get offended, even if we ask a critical question or a question that we want an answer to, we're going to be accused of some kind of offense against them or discrimination against them.
Well, I mean, I think Jesus was accused of all sorts of things, wasn't he, as well? So maybe that's par for the course.
I mean, it is. I mean, one of the things you asked me in your message to me, why is it that we are seeing so many, so much of animosity towards the preaching? And that's a very good question. I've been asked it a number of times. And, even as Easter is coming up now, we recognize the Passion Week and historical context. And one of the things in the historical context is the Roman ruler asked the people, who would you have? Would you have Jesus or would you have Barabbas? And, Barabbas was an insurrectionist, is a rebel against the Roman authorities. He tried to bring the Roman government down. And the people said, no, we don't want this Jesus. Give us Barabbas. So they chose a murderer insurrectionist over a man who was who they couldn't find anything wrong with. Why? Why would they choose that? Because Jesus was convicting them of their hypocrisy. He was showing them that the religious system wasn't working, that the rich would sit at the front of the synagogue and the poor would sit at the back, and special preferences were given to people, and sin reigned. And so the more man is provoked about his wrongdoings, the more he responds in anger and animosity.
So that's Pastor Dia Moodley. The full version of that will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, it's good. Also, the thing I particularly like about Dia is he's not following this evangelical Christian Zionist line at all on Gaza. He recognises what's going on there. There is an attempt, though, it seems, to sucker many evangelical Christians and similar into, in fact, the parts of like the Brethren and people like that, these sort of cult-like Christian organisations, to say that what's happening in Israel is God's will and Netanyahu's doing God's will.
Well, obviously, I don't agree with that. And many of the things that Pastor Moodley agrees
that
with,
is an I don't extreme, agree with, I would say that's
but I would agree with him about that.
I'd say an extremist point of view, wouldn't you? It should be on
well,
Michael
it is an extremist point of
Gove's list, anyone yes. that yes. says things like that. So before the break, we've got just a bit of a little poem from Patrizia Opulenza, and we'll be just looking at the National Insurance and State Pension briefly. But first, from Patrizia, resident poet, the race rows and censorship, the net closes in. Hester, Frank, thoughts in his head, out of mouth come, things he's said. Donations to the party, cons, on shaky ground to right the wrongs. Tourette's, perhaps, Frank suffers from, or boundary lines, maybe he has none. His words quite cruel and not okay, free speech now seen as not au fait. Race rows, offences, offensive labels. The horse has bolted from the stable. A race to the top of greasy sneaks who listen in to try to peek on racist slurs, rights and wrongs, words in the heat of moments gone. Diane, Azar, Lee, Hester too have all been censored. This much is true. Grooming public minds we see. Say what we say, not what you see. Some people's words are clumsy, true. Out of mouth, now in a stew. Return donation, loud cries now here. But digging deep, perhaps they fear donations with agendas clear, where faces, names kept out of sight. Whose hands on evil wars just might? Thank you, Patrizia. On this topic we talked about right at the very start, Martin, just before we go to the break, this chap, Jonathan Ashworth, was on LBC, I think, this week, talking about the potential assault by the Tories on national insurance. Now, there is you're quite right, and so is Steve, who we had on last week, to say that the national insurance pot is not doesn't really mean anything anymore. It all comes out of general taxation, the money that goes on the welfare state, the National Health Service, etc. But I think the point remains, and we'll get your comments after we've heard from the Labour, I think he's shadow paymaster general, if I'm not mistaken, Jonathan Ashworth, as he says that what the Tories are trying to do is just get rid of any idea of the welfare state and national insurance.
Well, first of all, they actually, a couple of years ago, as you will recall, broke the triple lock. But nonetheless, the triple lock is in place. But of course, the consequence of them freezing the income tax threshold means that increasing numbers of pensioners are being dragged into paying income tax, on average around £1,000 worse off. And the questions we are putting to the Conservatives today is this. We know they've got a £46 billion unfunded commitment on national insurance. So that provokes a number of questions for me. If you're abolishing national insurance, that is a way in which you get your entitlement to your state pension. How will your state pension entitlement be built up? Are they moving away from the contribution-based system? Or they are suggesting that pension entitlement for you and me in the future will be decided differently? Will it be means-tested, for example? These are questions the Conservatives need to answer if they're abolishing national insurance. The second part on that, if their argument is no, we're not doing that, and that Labour, it's not an unfunded commitment, we're actually just going to introduce some new merged payroll tax, Well, of course, pensioners don't pay income tax. So that suggests to me that pensioners' savings, pensioners' works pensions will be dragged into paying a higher rate of tax in the future as well. So we need to know these answers from the Conservatives on their £36 billion.
There we are. That was Jonathan Ashworth speaking at breakfast time this morning. This is LBC News.
Yes, it was LBC. But anyway, I think he's raising some important points there. It seems to me the Labour Party are starting to show that there is a little bit of clear blue water between them and the Tories.
Well, I mean, the Tories coming out with "we're going to abolish national insurance altogether" was a bit out of the blue. I mean, to reduce the payment of the national insurance, well, that's
I don't think the Tories have said that, have they?
No, they have. They've suggested that they might get rid of it altogether, which is why he's responding.
Right.
Because they're basically saying, so the whole basis of the welfare state that we've had up to now, is that the thing about national insurance, which is problematic, is that there's a cut-off at about 30 grand or 40 grand. And if you're wealthy, there's a top rate of national insurance that you pay, and it doesn't go more than that, just the same as with the council tax.
Are you suggesting then that it's a tax which falls more on poorer people than middle income people?
That's right, rather than income tax.
So it's not a progressive tax?
Well, it's not a progressive tax, no. I mean,
regressive?
Well, it's not entirely regressive, but the point is what's happened, the tax take in Britain is the highest it's been for many, many years, but what's actually happened is the people who pay the taxes have changed.
Yeah.
Back in the 1950s, it was the wealthy who paid taxes, and poorer people, by and large, did not have to. They didn't have to pay the rates, for example. If you were renting a room in a house, and many people did, you don't have to pay the rates. It's the owner of the house who has to pay the rates. So the house is what's rateable, because of its rateable value. And what's actually happened over the years, and the Tories have made a big deal out of this, they have put money in the pockets of the wealthy people who vote for them and fund them, like this chap, Hester. And that's what's happened. So although poorer people are paying a lot more tax, but wealthy people, in fact, pay a lot less tax than they used to do in the benighted 1950s, where the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. It was normal in many countries. Not anymore, eh?
Well, red lines from Putin in an interview which has hardly been covered at all here in Britain. Very important, though, pre-election interview by Vladimir Putin over in Russia, as well as the miners' strike and the Order of the Nine Angles, accelerationism, after the break.
20. In this reading, Jeremiah is remonstrating with leaders in Jerusalem over their abandonment of God in favor of making alliances with other nations for their own gain. He warns that those countries with whom they have made allies will become their rulers, and the people of Israel will be scattered. Lift up your eyes and see those who come from the north. Where is the flock that was given you, your beautiful flock? What will you say when they set as head over you, those whom you have trained to be your allies? Will not pangs take hold of you, like those of a woman in labor? I will scatter you like chaff, driven by the wind from the desert. This is your lot, the portion I have measured out to you, says the Lord, because you have forgotten me and trusted in lies. Woe to you, O Jerusalem! How long will it be before you are made clean? Here ends the first lesson.
flesh are tearing me apart. Oh, there's so much for me to overcome. Should I stay and fight? But where else is there I can go?
How can I get up? There's no way I can get up. How can I get up? There's no way I can get up. How can I get up? There's no way I can get up. How can I get up? There's no way I can get up.
I don't like the living, but there's no time for giving. No reassurance.
That was Forgotten Town by the Christians in 1987. That was the sort of stuff that was blasting out all the time in those days. You know, I quite like that one. Before that, we had the 1977 Disco Inferno by the Tramps. And before that, again, the United States Air Force Protestant Chapel Choir, would you believe, with a good song for Lent. Is Lent, folks, if you're feeling brave, you can start fasting now, water only, until Easter Sunday. I'm afraid I'm not quite that brave. It's a good idea to say something a bit about fasting. The proper fast, of course, is just water. You do have to be a little bit careful that you're medically able to do it, because some people aren't. And what you do is you just only eat, only drink water and nothing else, and over several days. I've done this a few times, and the second day is the worst. So, say for example, today, Friday, I stop eating. The Saturday is going to be the really difficult day, because you actually get things like headaches, you start feeling terrible. You don't particularly feel hungry, but you don't feel good. And once you get, in the case I'm doing, say to the Sunday, 2 days afterwards, 3 days afterwards, you start feeling a lot better. But just have, you know, plenty of water around and keep doing that. And it's actually extremely good for your body. As anyone who knows anything about fasting knows, your body uses it as a opportunity to shut down your digestive system, which takes a great big breather and said, phew, thank goodness for that. and your body then is concentrating on getting lots of toxins out of your system, as it does when you fast. So it's not just a good spiritual thing to do. It's also extremely good health-wise, so long as you're able to do it. And so don't just take my advice. Make sure that if you are going to fast in the run-up to Easter, in Lent, that you do it carefully and you do it properly. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start by talking, and we're going to be talking in a minute about the 40th anniversary of the miners' strike with the former BBC Radio 4 correspondent who covered the miners' strike for the BBC in the 1980s, Nicholas Jones, and has written various books about it. But the reason, of course, we're interested in the miners' strike is because of modern energy policy, the zero carbon energy policy. So we'll be talking about that too. But we'll start, Martin, with Russia. And here is this morning's BBC announcement about the, I think it's taking place over, am I right, over 3 days, Martin? Is that right?
Yeah.
The presidential election takes place in Russia. Here's the BBC's version of the news.
Russians are voting in a presidential election, which is almost certain to be won by Vladimir Putin. Territories occupied or influenced by Russia in Ukraine, Moldova and Georgia are also taking part in the three-day contest. Mr. Putin is the only serious candidate, with his main opposition rivals either dead, in prison or exiled.
Well, that's a rather partial account of what's happening, is it not? I'm not quite sure whether Moldova and Transnistria are voting in this election. Maybe that's not even factually correct. But the whole
are they parts of the Russian Federation?
Well, not obviously the four breakaway oblasts in East Ukraine. They are part of the Russian Federation because they were formally became part of the Russian Federation through referenda. I think Transnistria, which is a Russian-speaking region near the Dniester River, you know, on the edge of Moldova, between Moldova and Ukraine, I'm not sure that they are officially part of the Russian Federation.
The BBC is telling us there that all Putin's opponents are either banned, jailed, or dead.
Well, that's just rubbish. The Communist Party are the biggest opposition party in Russia. They were the ones who pushed for the recognition of the breakaway republics in the East Ukraine, and Putin and the United Russia were resisting the Communists saying that they should do that. They will come second. Putin will undoubtedly win. They've got the similar system in Russia as the one they have in France, which they don't have in the United States or Taiwan, for example. If you don't get 50% of the votes in the first round, there is then a second round, which is why there was such a fuss to try and make sure that Yeltsin was re-elected back in the day so that the privatization program could be forced through. They needed to get him over 50% in the first round, otherwise there'd be a second round and he'd probably lose. Those are the rules in Russia, and Putin will undoubtedly get more than 50% in the first round. But the Communist Party candidate, whose name I've forgotten begins with K, he stood before, he's not Grudinin or Zyuganov. You see, we're not having any discussion about who are the politicians in Russia. Do you see what I mean? There is actually more politicians than Putin.
It's almost
but we don't imagine anything about
the Russians.
Because as far as we're concerned, Putin's
doing
the only Russian politician.
Yeah, the Russians doing political commentary on British politics without mentioning Keir Starmer.
That's right. In other words, we are presented with Putin is the only serious contender, blah, blah. He's the only serious contender because he's very popular.
To be fair, the Labour Party here are more contenders than the Communists over in Russia. So what's the rough strength of the Communists in the Duma?
I suspect that they got about 50... The last Duma election in 2019, United Russia nearly lost their 50% control of the Duma. In the end, they retained it. But that means that more than 40% of people in those elections voted for non-United Russia parties. But they're all split into, you know, the Communists are the biggest. Mm. Then there is the Liberal Democratic Party, would you believe, which is actually quite a far-right party. And then there is another party called Fair Russia, which breaks the 5% barrier and they get people elected as well. United Russia are dominant in the Russian political system in the same way as the Liberal Democratic Party are in Japan. They virtually always win. But is Japan democratic? Because the same party wins all the time. Is it democratic in Japan? The Democratic Party in Japan did briefly have some control of the government, but they didn't last long.
I was hearing today, I think it was on the World Service, the very last item in one of their bulletins at lunchtime, that there's been a scandal in Japan where all of these politicians have been caught in some sort of sex party.
Well, figure me unsurprised. I mean, we're talking about Russia here. What the West will try and spin this as is Putin has killed all of his opposition, and that's why. What would be interesting is the level of turnout. Yeah, you'd think if people were disaffected with Putin, there'd be a low turnout. But I suspect that in Russian elections, there's going to be a high turnout, far higher than the United States, and probably far higher than in our by-elections. And, under those circumstances, it's puerile for the West to claim that Putin does not have a mandate to govern the country, because he does. And you're never going to solve our problems with Russia by taking the view that what the Russians think doesn't matter. They must be wrong. It's people like Rishi Sunak who knows how the Russians think, because he's so well connected with the people down in the streets in Vladivostok. He isn't.
So I thought I'd on that RT interview that George Galloway did last week or this week, I'm not quite sure, I think it was last weekend, which we're not allowed to see here, it's all banned and blocked by the censors. Well, of course we are in a free country, but the censor, the news from Russia.
Well, I mean, if we're going to ban things, then maybe our elections aren't free, Tony.
Isn't it bizarre that...
we have elections, but we can't hear everybody's point of view. That's not free, is it?
In order to hear our new MP, George Galloway, we've got to go to a banned station in Russia to hear it. Anyway, here he is talking about the Russian sanctions.
The father of the House of Commons who led me into the chamber to swear in yesterday very purposefully wore a tie which was in fact a Ukrainian flag, and only the sharp-eyed will have noticed it already, but I noticed it immediately. So the early signs are not that great, facts get in the way of political rhetoric and political ambition. The wish does not become the reality. And the wish that Russia should be defeated in the proxy war over the dead bodies of Ukrainians waged by NATO does not in any way guarantee victory. Indeed, it has been the prelude to complete defeat. So NATO has been comprehensively defeated, I would argue humiliated, in this proxy war. The one thing you can say has been proved is that Russia will not be conquered. It will not be balkanized, broken up into pieces, the better to be feasted upon and exploited, turning one piece against the other in the interests of an American-led NATO alliance. We can say for sure now that is not going to happen. And so, you know, why reinforce failure? Or, as my mother used to say, why throw good money after bad? We've already beggared our economies in pursuit of this foolhardy mission. And now that we know that it has failed, why keep sacrificing young, I say young, it's older and older Ukrainian men. And now even women are in the graveyards in Ukraine. Why keep sacrificing more and more Ukrainians? Why keep beggaring more and more of our economies? Germany's deindustrialization, Britain's in recession, the self-harming effect of sanctions on Russia is such that you like to think that somewhere in government there's a pragmatic voice saying, you know, we need to cut our losses here. And that's certainly what I'll be fighting for, as I always have done.
So, so that's George Galloway speaking on RT there about Russian sanctions, making these basic points about, you know, wouldn't it be sensible to just sort of draw a line and end the conflict? The Ukraine is running out of young people, even middle-aged people, to actually fight the war for them.
Well, that's right. And as you say, it's quite extraordinary that George Galloway has to go on RT, which is banned in this country. You can't, you know, people can't get RT, although obviously you've managed to do it by, you know, the magic of the internet.
Yeah, it's called the Tor browser, by the way, folks. Yeah. I'm not sure what it stands for. And I think it's actually, Dave, our sound engineer, was telling me it's actually owned by the Navy, a naval intelligence or something. But the Tor browser does enable you to just bypass these sensors. And there are other ways too, virtual private networks, VPNs, that you can use. But that's probably the most simple way. Just download that browser. That we can hear him, but only by trying to go back. This is the voice that they don't want us to hear, and he's an elected MP. I mean, from a general media point of view, you would have thought that the voice of Galloway, contentious, exciting, interesting, new, that's going to bring your audience in, and advertisers too. But it's quite clear that the media in this part of the world isn't interested in getting an audience. It's interested in promulgating a specific view of the world and a narrative.
That's certainly true.
As we heard from Judith Brown last week.
Yes, I think that's certainly true. I think that the denial about what's happening in the Ukraine and with Russia is worse than the denial over Gaza. Because, you know, most people, even Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak, can bring it in their hearts to say that the Israelis are killing too many civilians. But, of course, what's happened in the Ukraine has been disastrous and appalling, and potentially could lead to a nuclear war. And common sense voices, which George Galloway is in this case, saying, look, we can't just, you know, carry on with this, are marginalised in the mainstream. Most people are still of the belief that the unprovoked attack by the Russians on the poor old Ukrainians, and what, you know, we've got to defend them to the death and all the rest of it, this is very much 3 years old news. And of course, it's just wrong. And there's a big panic now setting in the West about the fact. I mean, there was a leaked report this week, which went to Marianne, which is a French magazine, which was written by the French army for Macron, explaining what's happening in the Ukraine. And they were saying there is no way for the Ukrainians to win. The Russians are the best in the world. And instead of comments that Macron was saying about sending the French army to the Ukraine, he said, well, if we go to the Ukraine, it will be as cheerleaders because we can't do anything else. There is no way.
What does he mean by that?
Well, what he means by that is that the French army, the British army and the US army together, if they turned up in the Ukraine, would be smashed by the Russian army, which is probably the best army they've ever had.
When he says cheerleaders, he's saying that this is just be for PR to show on the TV. What does he mean exactly?
Well, the thing I was reading was saying, well, this is a translation, a machine translation. But basically what the French army are telling Macron is if we turn up, there is no way we can make any difference to this whatsoever. You can imagine the Russians are going to see a punch like that coming a mile off. So the tanks set off from Paris to head towards Ukraine. And do you think they're going to get there before the Russians knock them out? Of course they're not. How are you going to get the tanks there? They're talking about giving them modern Western aircraft. Where are they going to fly from? They can't fly from inside the Ukraine. If they fly from Poland or Romania, then those bases are open to attack. And of course, this is what Putin has made clear. If Britain, for example, decides to fight Russia in the Ukraine, we won't just fight you in the Ukraine. You've got lots of bases in Britain, Salisbury Plain, Portsmouth, you know, we will hit those bases. Yeah. You'll have to get your tin hats on. Akrotiri in Cyprus. That'll be a legitimate target, wouldn't it? Yeah. You're bombing Yemen. Maybe it's time for you to be bombed. You know. Oh, you've got some nursery schools there for the people. Oh, well, we won't bomb the nursery schools directly. We'll bomb the airbase. And we'll kill as many people as possible, especially ones in uniform. That's the way the Russians fight. And if we go to war with them, that's what they'll do.
So where is this going to go then, do you think, this conflict? Is it, what has happened is it's provided the West within it an excuse to test out its AI weapons systems connected up with the drones. It's also, been able to launch its, coming up to their sell by date, Storm Shadow missiles and sink half the Black Sea fleet virtually.
Well, that's their propaganda that they've done that. The Russians are deliberately fighting with one hand tied behind their backs because they don't, you know, they've got world public opinion to deal with. And therefore they're trying to show that we are always trying to find a way out here, but we're not going to give up our fundamental objectives. The people in the East Ukraine do not want to be part of the Ukraine. They don't speak Ukrainian. They don't see themselves as Ukrainian. Historically, they were always part of Russia before the Russian Revolution. And the Russian Revolution created the state of the Ukraine. Modern Ukraine has got various bits tacked onto it by Khrushchev in 1964 and by Stalin in 1946, who put on bits of Hungary, Romania, and so on, and Poland were put part into the Ukraine. So the Ukraine has never really existed as a modern state until 1991, and the Crimea never wanted to be part of the Ukraine. They voted several times to leave it. Kosovo never had a referendum before they went to war with Serbia. We're Albanians. We don't want to be part of Serbia. We know that, that Kosovo was historically part of Serbia going back to the Middle Ages, but we're the majority now, and we want out. And the RAF bombed Serbia, killed their weather girls, killed thousands of civilians, bombed infrastructure, because it was a matter of principle, Tony. When people want to be free, like the Kosovo Liberation Army, a bit like Hamas, I mean, Hamas, Kosovo Liberation Army, what's the difference? There is no difference. They're terrorists, aren't they? No, they're freedom fighters, Tony. Kosovo Liberation Army, freedom fighters, Hamas, terrorists.
You may have been following this, but Macron is again suggesting that NATO troops should go to Ukraine. Last week he said this. He's now saying it again. Last week, Vladimir Putin, in an interview in Russia, said that if that happens, that NATO needs to be aware that they have nuclear weapons and they're prepared to use them if necessary. If there's any threat to the integrity of Russia itself, they will use nukes.
Yes, they will. That's their strategic doctrine, and it always has been. If, I mean, in actual fact, British, French, Polish, and other NATO troops have been fighting in the Ukraine, but they've been classed as mercenaries. And, of course, the Russians killed a load of French mercenaries in a hotel a few weeks ago. And these mercenaries are usually highly skilled people, because the Ukrainians can't use all this high-tech weaponry. They need to have NATO-trained people to use it. But the Russians are very well aware of who these people are and where they are, and they killed them. Now, if France openly goes to war with Russia, then French military bases inside France become open to attack. And the Russians have got the capability to knock out military bases in France. Their Kinzhal and Iskander missiles, their hypersonic missiles that the Russians have got, can hit anywhere on Earth within half an hour.
Well, I don't know if you'd heard it, but this week the Pope actually spoke out about Ukraine. He said it's time to have a... Let's have a listen now to this being discussed by... I think it's Judge Neapolitano, who calls himself... it escapes me. I'm sure some of our listeners will know exactly what I'm talking about. He does a regular YouTube, and it's brilliant, actually. He talks to people like Scott Ritter, etc., about various things. But here he is talking to what was Ray McGovern?
He's a retired CIA.
All right, so the white flag, of course, is obviously a turnoff for the Ukrainian people. As you pointed out, just dropped the phrase white flag and said, have the courage to negotiate. And then he could have said, and if the Americans are involved in the negotiation, the killing could stop tomorrow. But I don't know that he was going to go there. But we know that, don't we, Ray, that the killing would stop tomorrow if Joe Biden said, OK, let's negotiate.
In both Ukraine and in Gaza, unfortunately. Yes, the President of the United States still has the power to turn the faucet on or off.
Well, on or off, what is the your opinion about the mastermind of the coup in Ukraine in 2014 and the orchestrator of the war, Victoria Nuland, who is no longer with the State Department? Did she jump or was she pushed?
I believe she was pushed. And I have a speculative scenario here. On the 29th of, on the 31st of January, I have some notes here. Nuland went to Kiev to rearrange the chairs on the deck of the deck of Kiev. And she got Zelensky to go to London, and she got Zelensky reaffirmed, and then she got Sirsky coming in, the army general, who immediately sacrificed many troops trying to relieve Avdiivka, okay? So what else did she do? Well, in a very strange, extremely strange press conference of a kind, out in the street, it appeared, not in the headquarters of Zelensky, she said this: Mr. Putin is going to get some nice surprises on the battlefield, and Ukraine will make some very strong success. Okay, so now that's the 31st of January. On the 19th of February, we have these Luftwaffe senior Air Force generals of the German Air Force saying, look, you know, we need to prepare a briefing for Defense Minister Pistorius to make sure that he knows how the Taurus missiles would work, whether they could take out the Crimea Bridge, whether they could take out ammo dumps in Russia. We have to prepare that. Now, what does that have to do with this? Well, if Russia intercepted that, which I think almost certain, so did the U.S., okay? NSA has that capability.
Right.
So we're talking about Nuland promising this thing on the 31st of January, and then, what, 2.5 weeks later, you have the Luftwaffe generals discussing how they would deploy this Taurus missile, which is greater range than most other missiles. And they even say, you know, this is a political thing. This isn't going to change the course of the war, but Pistorius wants this briefing. Now, why did Pistorius want this briefing? His boss, Scholz, had already said, we're not going to give the Taurus.
Do you know anything about that story, Martin?
Yeah, I do. I mean, she's taken early retirement from the State Department, and there's various speculations about whether she's jumped ship or whether she's been pushed out. And obviously, Ray McGovern, the ex-CIA guy there, thinks that she's been pushed out. The implication of her being pushed out is that there might be a change of policy on Ukraine. Although stuff I've been reading is that a successor, this guy John B. Bass, B-A-S-S, is just as bad. I think the real problem for the West at this stage is they don't have a plan B, because they just presumed that Russia would crumble, and it hasn't worked out. They just presumed, for example, that the Israelis are just going to win the war on Hamas, which hasn't worked out either. And, you know, I read a lot of the sort of military analysis of what's going on, and there's a lot of delusion in the West because of what happened after 9/11 and after the 1999, the idea that we can just invade countries and we always win. Although in actual fact, it turns out that all the places we've invaded, we've actually lost. We've killed millions of people. We've destroyed the infrastructure of these countries. We've caused endless misery, but we lost. And that is the story of Western imperialist intervention. Whereas the Russian military, frankly, I can't think of anything serious that they've lost. They didn't lose in Afghanistan. They withdrew because they realised it was pointless. That's not the same thing.
Ukraine and Russia, apparently Kiev is planning a serious operation in Crimea. I mean, this is maybe why that so many Russian ships have been sinking. This is in the Independent. And Zelensky is slamming the Pope for what he said about there should be peace there.
Yes, well, I don't know if you've seen the thing about the two German Air Force generals talking about using Taurus missiles to take out the Kerch Bridge. Pepe Escobar, yeah, and the Russians got hold of the transcript, and it's caused a huge row because Schultz, the Chancellor of Germany, was saying, well, there's no way we're going to take German soldiers into Ukraine like the British and the French, which caused the British and French to be really annoyed because they didn't want him to say that, because otherwise we'll end up at war with Russia. But then the Russians released the transcript of a private conversation between two Russian Air Force generals about how they were going to use Taurus missiles to take out the Kerch Bridge. And they'd obviously been discussing it with the Americans without discussing it with the Chancellor of Germany. So you can tell who runs Germany. And it ain't Schultz, it's the Americans. And of course the British with whispering in the Americans' ear. Or is it them just telling us what to do? I think that's more likely, isn't it?
Okay, finally from antiwar.com today, Taiwan has confirmed American troops are in Kinmen. So what are they doing? I'm assuming that this Kinmen is part of Taiwan.
Yes, it's a little island.
Island near the Chinese
island,
coast.
Right, very close to the Chinese mainland. Yeah? And the people in this island are actually probably the most pro Chinese or the Taiwanese.
Some parts of the island are 2.5 miles away from China.
Yeah, so in other words, if the Chinese wanted to hop in there, they could easily do it. What's interesting about the Taiwanese presidential election is that because it's a first-past-the-post election, the guy who's won is very anti-Chinese and pro-independence for Taiwan. But if you add up the votes of the two people that lost, he wouldn't be the president.
Does America
if there was a second round in Taiwan, he wouldn't have been the president.
I mean, does America
want... I'm sure the Chinese
can see
that. Does
America want a war with China? That seems to be what this is a provocation, isn't
it? They openly say that they do. It's not as if do they want one. They say, no, we've got to break the legs of the Chinese before they become the dominant power on Earth. That's probably what's behind the COVID-19 epidemic.
Going
it was
on
a deliberate attack on the Chinese economy and society.
The same
the
with Russia during the Cold War. They were scared the Russians were catching up, weren't they? In fact, it nearly caused in 1962 a nuclear exchange, we're told.
Yes, but of course, the reality was that the Soviet Union was a paper tiger. Modern Russia is not, and nor is modern China. The West has got used to dominating the world for the last 500 years, and they think they can tell everybody what to do, and they'll all jump. Though those days are rapidly coming to an end.
Just a little excursus, as before we go on to the miners' strike. Judith Brown last week spent a little bit of time with us here. She's just started her new Substack, Control of Information, it's called. But I looked up some of the latest information about whether or not the British people trust the press. So this is from the Press Gazette last year. Trust in media. UK drops to last place of 28 nations. The annual survey asks how much people trust the media to do what's right. And the date of this article in the Press Gazette is difficult to... it's January 2024. That's pretty recent. The UK saw the biggest drop in trust in the media. It's funny, this wasn't reported in the media, was it? And was the least trusted out of 28 countries surveyed. The UK fell to the bottom of the ranking with 31% of people saying they trusted the media in a November survey, a drop of 6% since 2023. PR firm Edelman did not speculate about the reason for the UK's fall. The past couple of years, TikTok has rapidly risen as a news source. Prince Harry successfully exposed patterns of historical phone hacking at Mirror Group newspapers, won the right to take unlawful information gathering claim against the Daily Mail's publisher to trial, and the BBC, Hugh Edwards, and ITV, Philip Schofield, and GB News, Dan Wootton, have all been hit with presenter scandals. Respondents were asked to score institutions by how much you trust that institution to do what's right. Now, it's the lowest ever. And it's actually the bottom of the list, Britain.
Yeah, but the problem with that is the reasons why people distrust the media aren't clear. Yeah? And what is the media? Is GB News the media?
Well, in a way, it doesn't matter.
Well, no, because we're the media.
We're asking the population, the readers, the consumers, whether or not they trust what they're getting in the London media. And it is almost all focused in London, whether it's broadcast or print.
Well, so what we're the problem is when you say the media... That could mean we know what we're talking about. What you might, in order to break that down.
We're talking about the mass media here.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, but that's not clear. When people ask the question,
the most interesting thing brought up there, apart from the fact that the London media is a total mess and untrustworthy, is this TikTok story, isn't it? Because we've also heard in the United States that, the House has passed a Biden-supported bill to ban TikTok, and apparently the TikTok ban is due to the Gaza war. This has also been told us by antiwar.com this week. Washington's renewed urgency for TikTok ban is due to the war on Gaza. Isn't it funny how the algorithms for TikTok, they don't control, they're controlled by China?
Well, the algorithms for TikTok are controlled by, they're a commercial company that are trying to sell access to the media. So they've got lots of young people, as you know, use TikTok to look at dance videos and so on. And unfortunately for the Israelis and the Americans, they also use it to consume media about what's going on in the Middle East.
Well, the fact is that this is getting around the biased news media in London and in other parts of the world. TikTok is being used by people to share this stuff, knowing that it's not. They're not going to have algorithms to slow it down and stop it.
Yes, well, the TikTok executives are saying, look, the fact that our young audience generally supports the Palestinians is because our young audience generally supports the Palestinians. That's who they are. It's not because we're telling them to support the Palestinians. We're a commercial company. We're just trying to sell stuff to them. Yeah. So if they want to circulate this stuff amongst themselves, we're not going to stop them because we're a commercial company. We're trying to get the biggest audience we can for our stuff.
And of course, the problem is that they don't support you. What they're trying to do is intimidate TikTok to use the sorts of algorithms that people like Google use. So when you're searching for stuff on Google, you don't find what you're looking for if it's a particular political bent, like pro-Palestinian, for example.
Well, that's right. So in other words, they've been shocked by the way that social media has ended up not singing from the same hymn sheet as legacy media, and therefore the plan is to either use algos to squeeze out the things they don't like, and we all know about that. I mean, your stuff was non-monetized on YouTube years ago. This is how it works. The idea that we live in a free speech society is absurd.
Yeah. That was after I'd had a very, very successful pro-Brexit video, which got 1.7 million hits.
All right, well, the
algorithm suddenly changed and I got demonetized.
Yes, okay. Well, I mean, there are reasons for all these things. But of course, freedom of speech is a continuous struggle. If you don't exercise it, it's taken away from you.
One of the main reasons we have problems with the press is a question of ownership. Anything to say about that, Martin? Who owns the press?
Well, obviously, that's the key to it all, isn't it?
Well, there's a report out last year.
There is no freedom of speech when wealthy people have got a foghorn and you have to whisper.
Goldsmiths College has written a terrific report. Who owns the news? Mail, as in MAIL titles, News UK and Reach Dominate, that's the Daily Mail, obviously. News UK and Reach Dominate report finds three UK publishers control 90% of print reach and 40% of online reach. So this is again from the Press Gazette, which seems to be part of the New Statesman these days. I don't know how they managed to acquire that, but anyway, keep getting these New Statesman notes popping up, and this is from October last year. There are dangerous levels of concentrated ownership in the UK media, according to a new report which seeks to answer the question, who owns the news? Published by the Media Reform Coalition at Goldsmiths University, they now call it, found that three companies, DMG Media, that's the Daily Mail, News UK, that's Murdoch, and Reach, which is probably private equity of some sort, that they control the Mirror and the Express and... also quite a lot of local newspapers control 90% of the UK's national newspaper market. The analysis found while the combined average circulation of UK national dailies fell by 6% between 2020 and 2022, Metro, owned by the Daily Mail, has since the last report joined the Daily Mail and News UK's The Sun as leading titles in the national newspaper market by circulation, with each accounting for around one-fifth of the share of total daily circulation. Well, seems like Daily Mail have done quite well with the Metro, Martin, by making it free, so putting it at railway stations, which is where you mostly find it in the big cities. You don't really find it outside them. That is actually doing extremely well because people just don't have the money in their pocket to pay for a newspaper nowadays. The Metro's riding high.
Yes, and no doubt the advertisers who advertise in it making some money, and that's why they're prepared to subsidise it. It's we all know what goes on.
The guy's name's Tom Chivers. You know what? I think on this week's newsletter, if people are interested, I will include that as a PDF, send it out with our newsletter in a couple of days relating to this show. The data suggests if the Daily Mail were to succeed in its expected bid to acquire the Telegraph, it would increase its print market share to nearly half of the whole of the UK print market. So this is the situation that Jeremy Hunt, our wonderful Chancellor, has left, but when he got rid of quite a lot of the controls over how much press they're allowed to own, when he was Department of Culture, Media and Sport Secretary. Anyway, look, let's have a look at the miners' strike now. I think it will be interesting to start with Arthur Scargill, since this week, Martin, and maybe before we hear from him, you can comment on Arthur Scargill's reported by the Doncaster Free Press. I don't think that's owned by the Daily Mail. That at the rally he was speaking at last weekend, Scargill called Israel a fascist state.
Well, I wouldn't expect him to call it anything else. I mean, because it is. I mean, Smotrich, who's a government minister in Israel, said, I'm a fascist. He can call himself a fascist, but apparently if we call him a fascist, we're anti-Semites. It's absurd.
So what about Scargill as a character? He's quite interesting, isn't he?
Well, he is, obviously. He's a very much part of...
still going, amazingly. Well, even after leading the strikes in the 1980s.
Well, he's getting on
Didn't seem to do him any harm, did it?
I mean... Well, I mean, he's coming for huge amounts of abuse over the years.
Diane Abbott style stuff, really.
Well, yes, and worse. I mean, the book by Seamus Milne, The Enemy Within, shows how he was targeted by the intelligence services from a very early stage. And Roger Windsor, who was his right-hand man at the NUM, turned out to be an MI5 agent. And that's why, you know, that sort of thing led to the defeat of the strike, because they were up against the deep state in all of its glory.
But is he right about Israel being fascist? Do you think he is?
Yes. Let's call a spade a spade. The Jabotinsky right wing in Israel used to be based, Jabotinsky used to live in Italy, and he used to be friends with Mussolini. They are fascists.
Benjamin Netanyahu's father was Jabotinsky's private secretary.
That's right. The Jabotinskyites are a very recognised part of the Israeli political spectrum, and in the 1930s they were aligned with Mussolini. They saw themselves as fascists. That's their definition of themselves, not mine. Somebody should tell Michael Gove. Of course, incidentally, Meloni, who's the Prime Minister of Italy, she is from a fascist background. Her party was originally a part of the fascist party. Rishi Sunak went to visit her to talk about immigration. Maybe she's an extremist and we should have nothing to do with her.
Arthur Scargill told the audience last weekend, it's terrible that the fascist state of Israel has continuously bombed and shelled Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem for nearly 5 months. These territories are the land of the Palestinians, which Israel has unlawfully occupied since 1967. And unless Israel withdraws, I call on other nations to force back this fascist state. One critic who shared a clip of the speech on X, formerly Twitter, wrote, first words out of his mouth were to declare Israel a fascist state. He was there to mark 40 years of the miners' strike. So there is a little bit of contention, but this hasn't been reported as much as you might think. It's a bit Arthur Scargill is a bit like George Galloway. We're not really allowed to hear what he's got to say, are we?
Well,
even if
right.
It is contentious.
That's right. I mean, the main thing they've done with him is consigned him to the dustbin of history.
Anyway,
he's still alive.
Let's have a listen to another bit of his speech last weekend. This is Scargill talking about meeting a policeman who after the strike, who confessed to his role during the strike.
The chances of troops being brought in was a real threat. The plan was there. I've met them since. I travelled with Tony Benn on the train from Durham about 6 years after. And a young policeman said, I was at Orgreave. And we said, were you? He says, yeah, we were deployed. And we were told that we were there until the miners were defeated. But they are reserve powers and they were prepared to bring in troops. I did a question time programme in Ireland, Northern Ireland. And afterwards they put me in a hotel. And the bloke who was in charge of the evening, there were no sandwiches or anything, I asked him, can I get a cup of tea and a sandwich? And he said, certainly. And he started serving me. He says, long time since I saw you last. I says, have we met? He says, yeah, we met at Orgreave. I said, which pit? He says, I wasn't in the pit. I was on the other side. He said, but I was in the armed forces. But I had to be dressed as a police officer. And he was involved in it. So that took place. And we've got a right to understand what was taking place on the 18th of June. It was a state attack. an organised attack on the trade union movement. Negotiations. What happened? We settled the miners' strike 5 times, and every time we reached an agreement, Thatcher intervened. Don't believe me? I hate to say, don't go buy a copy of Thatcher's book, but it's in Thatcher's book. Take it from me. Well, he met on the 3rd of March, 1985. And after a bitter and sometimes really raucous conference, we had to take a vote. The three national officials made clear that they would not support any return to work. We called upon the union to stay out. The vote, when it took place, was carried by 98 votes to 91. The three national officials were amongst the 91 calling for the strike to continue. We were so close to victory, and yet here we were being told to go back to work.
So that was the end, really, of the miners' strike. But anyway, he's a very interesting character and quite fascinating to hear. Oh, as a soldier who's actually dressed as a policeman who's spying on you.
Yes, when Scargill came to speak in Bristol some years ago now, I did question him about Roger Windsor, of course, because he was the MI5 spy in the NUM. And if you read Seamus Mill's book, The Enemy Within, you will see that in actual fact, the miners came very, very close to victory. Thatcher was apparently in tears in cabinet because it looks as if the miners were going to win. And just at that point, Roger Windsor popped up in Libya, cuddling with Colonel Gaddafi to ask for extra funds.
Well, these are
which then, of course, led to the undermining of the NUM's position, etc. But Windsor was an MI5 agent. And of course, the whole thing was a planned takedown of the NUM as so that they could then move on to Thatcherise country.
Am I right in thinking that in the 1980s, the most powerful union was the miners' union? It represented industry. It represented those sorts of a direction that the powers that be around the world, particularly the United States, didn't want the British to continue in. And so the idea was to break the back of the miners' union, then the rest of the trade union movement will follow.
Absolutely. If you remember, I'm old enough to remember the two miners' strikes of the 1972 and 1974. And the miners went on strike in 72 and 74, and they won. And then, of course, Edward Heath went to the country saying, who runs the country, me or the NUM? And the country voted him out. Because in those days, people had a strong consciousness of trade unionism. And of course, it's come back to some extent
now. Because the trade
unions, people used to know what it was about.
Well, that's right. The voters voted for Arthur Scargill and his friends rather than Ted Heath. Well done.
Well, they didn't vote for Arthur Scargill. They voted Labour.
For the miners.
But they blamed Heath for the strike.
If Ted Heath is going to call an election, it's either the me or the miners. Who do you want to run the country? And they vote him out. Then it's is a vote for Scargill.
Well, exactly.
Anyway,
yes.
Look,
it wasn't Scargill leading the miners at that stage.
No,
it was Joe Gormley. But yes,
saying. Yeah. Anyway, Nick Jones was the BBC's Radio 4 correspondent. He's written several books about the miners' strike, and of course, this was the beginning of the end of British industry.
What's been going on in the last 40 years is short-termism. You know, the steel industry hasn't invested in new kit in some of these new arc furnaces. They could have been installed years ago. We could have updated the equipment, but we've lacked an industrial strategy. Now, this applies particularly to the coal industry, because you wouldn't believe it. Here we are talking about the start of the anniversary year of the miners' strike, and in the news is the announcement that the government is going to build a new generation of gas-fired power stations. Now, that's come about because in the 80s, because of the strike, the government abandoned any further attempt to develop clean burning of coal. Now, then the point was that in the early 80s, there were lots of schemes afoot to bring in a new generation of fire, of coal-fired power stations that would burn coal differently and that would be, you know, reducing the pollution level and reducing the carbon emissions, etc. Now, that was all abandoned. And, of course, then that was followed by the dash for gas in the 90s. That led to the mass closure of the collieries because there wasn't a new generation of coal-fired power stations coming along. And hey-ho, here we are in 2024, 40 years later. Later, the gas stations that were built in the 90s are now needing replacement. And the government knows that if, you know, there's a danger, unless we have new gas-fired power stations built and on standby, we could see the lights going out. And what an echo that is of the failure to think long term about the fact that beneath us, as Arthur Scargill always said, you know, there's enough coal, if it was burned properly and cleanly, to keep Britain powered and the lights on for a century or more.
That's the former BBC Radio 4 industrial correspondent Nicholas Jones, author of various books, and a long interview with him, or fairly long, is already up there on YouTube, and I'll put links up to that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So what he's saying, Martin, is basically short-termism.
Yeah, I mean, the real key to this is having an industrial strategy. The whole philosophy of Thatcherism was the government doesn't have to have an industrial strategy. The market will decide.
Oh, yeah, right.
And of course, they do have an industrial strategy, which is to get rid of, troublesome like Arthur Scargill and his friends, and move on to a service economy, which turns out to be the derivatives market in the City of London, which crashed in 2008.
Where you end up with millions and millions of people with no jobs, but they can own nothing and be happy.
Well, we know what's happened. There was a deliberate, I mean, Kaletsky, the Polish...
But they're cut out of the ability to look after themselves, aren't they, to actually manage to make a living?
The point I would make is that the Keynesian model of managing the economy, which had worked very well from 1945 till the 1970s, was unceremoniously ditched. And therefore, they brought in a 19th century model of the economy where all the government's got to do is control the money supply, and then the market will sort it all out.
Well,
and what that led to is the banking system controlled the money supply, and the rentier classes, they're not industrialists. These people make money through sharking.
Yeah.
And they have become the dominant.
Well, they've become
the
hedge funds.
Class.
And I was just reading earlier on today about how the hedge funds have been replaced by these private equity firms who basically are a government. They own everything. They own
That's
all the
right.
infrastructure. And they're not really interested in massive amounts of gambling, but they make lots more money. And the money has flown since, flowed. This is actually Case van der Pale's book, States of Emergency, I've been reading. The money has flowed from the old hedge fund gambling system into this kind of BlackRock Vanguard State Street style. Well, if you put your money here, it's safe as houses because this is the infrastructure of the world you're investing in here.
Yes, and of course, as Hudson points out, Michael Hudson, the economist, the ideology of no plan is an ideology. There is a plan. It's just a plan that's run by the City of London and Wall Street. Governments having no plan means that they make the plan and they tell the government what to do. Now, in the old days, there was a more robust attitude. In the 1940s, for example, when we were at war with the Israelis, if people remember, there was a more robust attitude towards the role of the government in the economy. And large chunks of the British economy were owned by the government.
Anyway,
and they could have a plan.
We're now in a situation where we've got this zero carbon policy, which, of course, stops coal. But, I mean, no, it doesn't really, because we've got this clean coal, but we don't want clean coal. We just don't want you using coal because you've got loads of it. And one of the people who's been critiquing this is a chap called Stephen Koonin, Stephen with a V, K-O-O-N-I-N. He's written a very, very successful book called Unsettled, about the science around climate science.
On the pleasant surprise side, I'll just start with the numbers, right? We've sold, last I checked at the beginning of this month, 150,000 copies. Between that and the audiobook and the e-books, for a book of this type, I had no sense of what to expect, but my agent and publisher say it's spectacular. So that's been pleasing to see that there's a receptivity to the message. I get many unsolicited emails from people who aren't climate scientists, engineers, scientists in other fields, business folks who say, thanks for writing this. Because what I think I did was to provide a framework in which to think about climate issues and to some extent energy issues, and then filled it in. I was very careful in writing the book to stick so almost entirely to what was in the official reports at the time or the peer-reviewed literature. So it's very difficult for a climate scientist to say, you got it wrong. Nevertheless, there are many climate scientists in public who will say, Koonin's not a climate scientist, he's a show for oil companies, et cetera, et cetera. But when you look at factual criticisms, it's pretty thin. I was disappointed when about a dozen climate scientists, firmly, rabidly in the consensus, wrote an article in Scientific American, more than 2,000, roughly 2,000 words, and almost all of it was an ad hominem attack on me. There were three substantive points about the science, and they were easily rebutted. I wrote such a rebuttal and submitted it to Scientific American, asking them to publish it. They refused without comment. And that's very disappointing. The tenor of the conversation is, in public at least, is awful.
So that's Stephen Koonin, the author of Unsettled. Stephen with a V, K-O-O-N-I-N. His more recent book, Martin, is called The Green New Deal, and that is subtitled, I can't quite read it. Actually, it's written by Jeremy Rifkin, that one, not by Stephen Koonin. But that also looks like an excellent book as well. Why the Fossil Fuel Civilization Will Collapse, by 2028, 4 years' time, and The Bold Economic Plan to Save Life on Earth. So obviously there's a little bit of sarcasm in there. So these books are coming out critiquing this kind of religion of zero carbon, Martin.
Well, Jeremy Rifkin, I think, is, I don't think he is a climate skeptic. The Green New, he's saying that fossil fuel civilization will collapse by 2028. That doesn't sound like he's a climate skeptic, Tony. He's a different kettle of fish. I mean, as we know, this debate continues.
This Green New Deal definitely needs a closer look at. I'll do that next week.
Well, all of these things need to be debated.
Anyway, Stephen Koonin has also got some interesting things to say about Greenland.
The review said, quote, this is from the Scientific American. They quote you, Greenland's ice sheet isn't shrinking any more rapidly today than 80 years ago. So the review quoted your statement. And then this is the statement from the reviewer, quote, but for a risk-based approach to climate discussions about what we should do, this statement is irrelevant. It is the future that worries us, end of quote. Now, Stephen, when reviews dismiss evidence, when reviews dismiss data, how can one respond?
Well, on that particular point, I responded, I got so mad, not only for the logical disconnect, but for conflating projections with what has been. I got mad enough, I wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that was published in February, where I had the temerity to get them to publish a graph with the actual data. And of course, the data show, first of all, the statement is correct. 1930s, Greenland was losing as much ice each year as it has in the last, let's say, at 2020. But more importantly, the graph shows a great deal of up and down, even as the globe warms, which suggests that there's something else going on besides the temperature getting warmer. And in fact, I cited, although the Wall Street Journal didn't put the references in, I cited peer-reviewed papers over the last few years that suggest it's got to do with long-term cycles in the North Atlantic. And again, if you look at the last 4 or 5 years, the rate of melting is actually going down And if those cycles are driving it, it'll go down and down again until 1940 or so. I'm sorry, 2040.
Yeah, so also, obviously, you know, he's quite clearly the author of Unsettled, Stephen Koonin. And what they're trying to say is that all the science is settled. Well, clearly it isn't. And there's quite a big debate raging about it. And the newspapers, the Scientific American, he's talking about there, really aren't, Martin, are they? They're not, they have already decided what they think is happening, and they're not, using, they're not citing his references, as he's saying. Anyway, look, let's get back to Nick Jones, the BBC Radio 4 correspondent, talking about the miners' strike. And he mentioned, to begin with there, the 1992 closure programme. Well, we think of the 1970s and the 1980s, don't we, as the big times where the pits were shut. Well, a lot of pits were shut, but there were the idea was they were arguing, well, of course we need coal. We need lots and lots of coal. It's just that the inefficient pits are going to close. Isn't that what they said in the 1980s?
That's what they said. And on that basis, of course, the Nottinghamshire miners, many of them went to work throughout the strike on the and they set up an alternative to the National Union of Mine Workers, Democratic Union of Mine Workers, or UDM. And they broke the strike, which of course helped to undermine the possibility of the victory. And then of course their reward from Michael Heseltine, who was the Energy Secretary, is actually we're going to close you all down. And they close them all down. And
George Galloway was able to exploit this this growing tension within the Muslim community, many of whom are in constituencies like Rochdale. So, you know, it was a classic own goal by the Labour Party. But I agree with you. It does point to wider failures. And that's why, of course, you know, when Labour pulled the plug on the $28 billion that they were going to invest in green energy, yes, they say they're going to do something, but, you know, the target isn't there anymore. That was why it was such a terrible, terrible shame. And it, as I said, it takes me back to the succession of failures over the coal industry. You asked me earlier, what were my memories? Well, the most significant memory for the coal industry was in the early 90s, because we used to have lots of conversations with the coal board, and they said, look, we can see the writing is on the wall. We can't persuade the government anymore to invest in a new generation of clean burn coal-fired power stations. We've got the coal, but we need the new kit. And they wouldn't give the loan guarantees for it. And Michael Heseltine said, no, we'll get a quicker return, a faster return, i.e. a quicker buck, if we go for gas-fired stations and use up North Sea gas, which is exactly what they did. So it was sort of classic short-termism. And then in 1992, they went ahead with it. And just think of this statistic. Michael Heseltine was very proud of the fact, and he told me this, and he's repeated this to me, that, look, he said, I negotiated £1 billion in 1992 for the redundancy payments at the 32 pits that we closed in 1992. That was the year of the mass pit closures. And he said, look, he said, I knew at the time that when it came to it, once we put the offer on the table to men at the pits, there would be a majority to take the money, and they took the redundancy payments. And that's classic short-termism, isn't it? Mm. And then you see John Major now reflects, he was up in the northeast last year, and he said, the northeast of England, he said, my biggest regret is that in the 1992, when we closed all those pits, we didn't do enough to provide a new generation of jobs. And he was looking at the desolation there is in these former mining communities. And I just thought, well, John Major, you know, you signed the cheque for the £1 billion, the short-term payoff, the redundo payments that people accepted. Of course they took the money, but there was nothing in its place.
Yeah, so nothing to really take over from coal, and nothing in terms of employment for many of these communities in the north of England and South Wales, decimated.
Well, that's right. I mean, whatever your views on climate change and all the rest of it, there's a way to manage things and a way not to manage them. If you decided, I mean, I would argue that some of the pits that were up for closure probably would have to have closed because they were no longer viable, just in financial terms.
Yeah, but hang on, because you think it's okay to import coal and for have that to compete with coal?
Yeah, well,
coal,
I mean, as you well know, coal comes into this country now from Colombia and places like that for making steel and so on. That's because we haven't got an integrated industrial strategy.
Well, this was the argument at the time, wasn't it? We can close these pits here and just import it. But actually, you can't control the conditions of the workers, the environmental impact when it's coming in from abroad.
Well, also, from a military point of view, you've got to control, energy is important. The blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline last September 1, that created a massive methane leak, one of the biggest methane leaks in history, massively destructive, if you believe in climate change caused by fossil fuels. But that was an act of sabotage carried out by the US military to prevent the German economy from competing with the US economy. And British intelligence services probably participated in that, as the Russians certainly suspect. That means that we have actually stabbed our own people in the back by doing that, to keep the Americans happy. And this has nothing to do with climate change. This is warfare. And the real threat facing humanity is nuclear war.
Yeah, well, nuclear...
Climate change, second, if that.
And nuclear power, too. So part of all of this is electricity. A couple of stories in This Is Money this week, which have been pretty shocking to me. The evidence is now in. We don't want your electric cars. Why half of used motor dealers won't buy second-hand electric vehicles. Survey of used motor dealers identified big concerns about buying electric vehicles. 2 in 5 much less interested in stocking them following last year's price fall. 30 used electric vehicles that have plunged most in value in 2023. So that's another article that you can look at there. Shocking depreciation of electric cars last year has made half of motor dealers wary of buying them to stock in their forecourts. According to a new report, owners of electric vehicles are being warned to expect little enthusiasm when trying to sell their battery-powered cars to dealerships. A poll of second-hand motor dealers by Honk Honk suggests more than 1 in 3 dealers said they're much less interested than a year ago in taking these vehicles on. Now, it does seem as if this is potentially, these are little white elephants that people have been conned into buying.
Well, I think what's going to happen is we're going to have a massive depression now. And in a depression, people don't buy new stuff. They stick with the old stuff. They keep their old car and they keep it on the road as long as they possibly can.
Isn't
they
this
don't
some
go out
sort
and
of
buy
scheme? It's like that clean air zone. It's a sort of help to sell scheme for the motor industry.
Well, that's right. And the
people have got to get rid of their old cars, scrap them. That's very green. You've got to buy a new one, and so you don't have to pay this, whatever it is, £12.50 or £9 charge every day.
What you're going to find is lots of people won't be able to afford to drive cars of any kind anymore, and they'll be on foot or on public transport. And
the wealthy will. I mean, the brand new cars are all fine.
Yeah,
no
but the wealthy will not provide enough demand to make the economy function. We're going to go into something like the 1930s.
I'm sure you can remember.
And in the 1930s, you only get out of that by a war or some kind of major plan.
I'm sure you.
That's the only thing.
I'm sure you can remember the Volkswagen mis-selling scandal over emissions. Well, how about this? Far, far worse. And let's see if these people get prosecuted. Revealed how far electric cars fall short of their advertised range. Where does your vehicle rank? Battery life of 12 electric cars tested was on average how many percent less than advertised, would you guess, Martin?
I wouldn't like to speculate.
30% less than actually. So you're buying something, it's telling you this, you're actually only getting 30%, you're getting 70% of the range that you've been sold. So electric car drivers may feel they have been ripped off after tests revealed that some vehicles have significantly shorter ranges than advertised. Measurements taken by What Car magazine found that some of the latest electric vehicles have up to a third less battery life than official figures advertised in brochures. They found out when the cars are driven in real world conditions, in colder temperatures as well, their batteries go flat much faster. Some cars showed battery shortfalls of close to 40% or 100 miles of what is advertised. And they've got a nice little graphic of these various extremely expensive cars. £75,000 is the most expensive one. And so What Car magazine is saying that this is a total rip-off. Anyway, let's also listen here to, this is done very well on YouTube this week, is My Electric Car is Now Worthless, says this YouTuber.
Basically, the initial cost of the car was £120,000. Now, the last time I did this a month ago, my Porsche offered me £44,650 for it. We Buy Any Car offered me £44,135. Motorway offered me £41,209. This is a month ago. And Carwow offered me 42,372. And flipping heck, listen to what they offered me, was £28,360. Now, I went back online today. I also got a quote off of Porsche off the dealership in exchange for the 911, what I wanted. But obviously they wasn't taking any more Taycans. They wasn't taking them. Taking them, get it? And he said it's roughly worth £41,500. So £41,500 if they were to take it, but they're not. This was that dealership. I'm not going to mention it. I don't want to lose him his job. I am going to go to Nottingham and Leeds, though, and see whether they'll take it. But I wanted that Porsche that they'd got in at that dealership. Anyway, we'll go back to that. We Buy Any Car, as of today, offered me 40,615. Motorway offered me, wait for this, £39,893. CarWow, who I quite like, their YouTube channel, I watch them, £41,616. And flipping heck, wait for this, £26,690, which is outrageous. So it leaves me in a massive, massive negative equity, because as of today as well, the balance to pay off my car with Porsche Finance is £64,664.15. So, basically, I'd be left in over £20,000 out of pocket, which I thought, well, what I would do is, if Porsche, the dealership, against the 911, would have taken my car, my car, and I would have been able to add that onto the finance. But if I sell it privately, like is suggested that I do, then I'm going to have to find the £20,000 to pay the finance company off, which is, I've not got all of it, you see. So I'm basically left with a car that's worthless. Even the dealership does not want this car back. So, yet again, electric cars, as I say, they're a throwaway item, they're disposable, and they're basically not fit for purpose. So if you're thinking of buying one, do not do it. You're going to be left in the same predicament that I've been left in.
Yeah, so that, not sure of the name of the YouTuber, but the actual YouTube is called My Electric Car Is Now Worthless. Even the dealership doesn't want it back. EVs are disposable junk. So he's obviously fairly forthright, and he's quite annoyed. Yeah, Martin, he's bought it on tick, and he's suddenly in negative equity, a bit like the whole housing market.
Yeah, and of course, electric vehicles are not necessarily that ecological either. Don't forget that they're made of metal like other cars, and metal involves all sorts of nasty things to make.
We heard the story from James Tweedy a few weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago now, about his mum who, she's still got the thing parked outside her house, but the dealership won't touch it. They won't fix it. They won't repair it. It was brand new when she bought it.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's going to happen, not just with electric cars, but lots of other goods, is as this crash gathers momentum, and I suspect before the end of this year we're going to be talking about this, people won't be buying new anything because they won't be able to afford it. And that will feed on itself. The banking system is in very, very ropey shape, because even though they're making a lot of money at the moment, it's all the commercial property market is about to collapse. That will pull down the banking system. Lots of developing countries are going to default, and we're not going to be in a progressive situation moving in any positive direction, certainly in Europe, because of the politics of what's been going on in the Ukraine. European economy is going to be devastated, and the consequence of that is quite possibly going to be civil war in many countries.
Okay,
and I'm not exaggerating.
Final piece from Nicholas Jones. I find him absolutely brilliant, because he's bringing in all these current news stories, like the gas announcement of new gas-fired power stations, which is obviously By the way, folks, have you noticed where all those trees are going along the sides of the roads? A lot of them are ash trees. trees, a lot of them are not ash trees, they're just being cut down in the daytime, in the nighttime, and they've been put on lorries and taken to Drax. So many of them are actually just being literally shredded, and a lot of the waste that comes with the trees is just making power now. So this is trees making power up at Drax Power Station. It's called biomass. This is covered quite well in the film by Michael Moore, Planet of the Humans. This crazy idea of just cutting down our trees and feeding them into electric power stations. Anyway, this is Nick Jones's final little excerpt, with a full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where I ask him about, were the pits actually just filled in when they were closed so they couldn't be used again?
There is one little anecdote that I've heard, and I'm not sure if you can corroborate it or not, that when once the pits were closed, there was a deliberate attempt to infill them with rubble of various sorts to make it very, very difficult for them to be reopened, even if that was just deemed necessary.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt at all that they were made safe, i.e. that they were access was prevented. You would need to dig a new shaft to be able to get to them. And, of course, many of those pits have actually been built on. I mean, up and down the country, you know, there are pictures of especially warehouses which have been built on the sites of the pits. So this is the point. You would have to build and start again with deep mine coaling if it was ever agreed to go ahead. I mean, there is this great debate up just north of the Lake District, you know, as to whether or not they're going to have a new coking mine up there. So, I mean, the debates go on, but you're quite right. I mean, the point is that to start again with the coal industry, we would need to begin right from the beginning and build new mines and new shafts. And that would be a phenomenally expensive operation.
Yeah, and if people want to follow this up and go and find out a bit about the coal industry as it was, there is a fantastic museum here in near Blenafon in South Wales called Big Pit, where they'll even take you down an old coal mine.
That's right.
And I believe there's also a place near Wakefield.
Yes, it's called the National Mining Museum, and they too have the opportunity to go underground. That's the National Mining Museum near Wakefield.
And what about, have you written about this? Have you got books out, that sort of thing, Nick?
Well, I mean, I do write quite a bit. I've written quite a few books about this whole area. A lot of them have been published by a group called the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. We've done numerous books on the miners' strike, especially, which was most important, was when we looked back at the cabinet records that were published under the rules that, you know, applied and still apply in many cases. A government's, a prime minister's records are published 30 years later under the 30-year rule. That's been shortened, but the point is that in 2014 and 2015, we got lots of Mrs. Thatcher's records coming through, and we could look through them. Wow. And my word, it was fascinating to see.
Anyway, have you got some titles for any listeners that are interested in getting hold of those books? What titles can you?
One of the titles is Settling Scores, which is all about the way in which it was pretty clear that you know what the government had been up to. That's Settling Scores. My own book is Strikes and the Media. I wrote that about the I wrote that in 1986, and that's all about the miners' strike. Another one is called Pit Props, and that's all about the international support that was given to the miners' union. So, and of course, if anybody wants to go on my own website and look under trade union reporting, that's nicholasjones.org.uk, you'll see I've got a whole section there on the stuff that I've written over the last 20 years. So what I try to do is make anything that I've written available online, and you can just look it up, and people can email me a message if they disagree or agree or whatever.
So that's Nicholas Jones, full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Former BBC Radio 4 industrial correspondent right the way through the miners' strike in the 1980s, and an author. I kind of cut him off there. It was a bit bad of me, really, when he was about to talk about the revelations of under the 30-year rule from the Thatcher era. Martin, I suppose the lessons really here are that there was a decision made that the you know, good, useful or not, these pits were never going to be allowed to reopen. There was a whole energy policy being imposed on the country, really.
It's not just to do with energy policy. It was to break the miners' union in order to break the trade union movement in order to change the direction of travel of the economy as a whole.
Nuclear is seen as something which almost operates on its own, isn't it, by remote control. You don't need any workers.
Yeah, but I'm making the point that it's not just energy policy that was changed by the defeat of the miners'
industrial
strike.
Workers' policy, trade union.
The policy towards the population, the idea of what the economy's for, who's supposed to be in charge of it, what we're trying to achieve here. It was a huge sea change. And a move towards the privatized bubble world we now live in, where these huge private equity firms and like BlackRock and all the rest of it control everything, and ultimately, of course, that's going to lead to defeat, because the Russians and the Chinese don't think like that. They think in strategic terms, which is why they're winning World War III and we're losing.
Talking of which, I got another ode from Patricia this week about Russia. To Russia with love. Cases packed with all their clothes, sun cream stashed so no red nose. To Russia with love, these fellows went, a job intact, guaranteed intent. Next thing they know, their civvies gone. This is a story, by the way, in the Metro this week about people going on holiday to Russia and then being told that they're going to have to fight for Russia against Ukraine, which is almost certainly propaganda. So anyway, next thing they know, their civvies gone, army clothes all told to don. Front line to fight, these men all say, were sent by Putin far away to fight Ukraine in mud waist deep, a video smuggled out to keep. Propaganda riding high, tall tales we read, oh my, oh my. Photos posted, where we're look, looks, seems propaganda, their time has took. Documents all swear they signed, 10 years in jail, said if declined. These stories in cheap rags can read on Big Bad Putin want folks to read. The tourists' economic claim, Russia with love is why they came. We hear the same about Ukraine, their army shot. So now contains youth, old men, girls and boys for NATO ghouls where death will toil. Psychology twisted, perchance now used. Our gullible readers, their minds abused. No facts are checked, no follow-ups. But if we question, then they erupt. Faux facts and missing information clear. Hence, from MSM, we must steer clear. Well, sounds. I know which way you voted in that poll last year about do people trust the media, Patricia. Thank you very much again. Final item, Martin, is about the extremism this week. And I had a chat to Andy Gordon over in Dunedin in New Zealand about, because he's been digging away into this Christchurch mosque massacre. He just doesn't kind of stop, really. But he's also making links to this satanic Nazi death cult, the Order of the Nine Angles. Now, if you're going to ban something, if you think that the extremists are worth identifying it, why is there so much concentration on the Muslim Council of Britain and organisations like this and not Order of the Nine Angles, the far-right Nazi death cult?
Because the decision was made to demonise the Muslim community after the 9/11 attack was carried out by the US and Israeli security forces, so that they could then go to war with the rest of the world. The Muslims have the misfortune to sit on top of lots and lots of our natural resources that we need. I mean, we're getting rid of our own coal industry, but we want to control the oil industry in Iraq, for example, and therefore the Muslims have to be demonised so that we can go to war with them and steal their oil. Didn't work, by the way, because of course in Iraq they're talking to the Chinese about selling their oil. Since we're not going to need a new oil anyway because of the green industrial revolution, doesn't matter, does it? It's all dirty tricks.
Okay, so Andy's done a real good look at the Order of the Nine Angles again. A few more bits and pieces of information, also the links to Brenton Tarrant and the Christchurch mosque massacre.
Thomas Carrick, this 13-year-old lad, was passed from person to person. So once someone who was not too extreme had become his so-called friend on social media, he was then passed on to someone who was far more extreme. But all of these people apparently were undercover officers. Now, this just sounds utterly, completely abusive. You've got, well, as they say, you know, this is not your local police. They did the sensible thing, the right thing, which was to go and, you know, talk about this to the local mosque and, you know, to normal Muslims, not to these internet troll
intelligence police maniacs or whoever they were. But Thomas was investigated and charged with two terror offences by this thing called the Joint Counter-Terror Team, who'd been grooming him. And it comprises the Australian Federal Police, so that's not the individual states, that's the national cops, and Victoria Police, who are the more local cops, and also ASIO members. So do you know who this ASIO is?
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure who they are, but I mean, they've got all these anti-terror organisations, haven't they? And, you know, the intelligence operations now, it is changed a lot because it is more predominantly online. You know, they don't need to send people out into the field anymore. They've probably got, you know, these offices filled with hundreds of people, you know, looking for these people, radicals and so on. But I think this case, it really demonstrates, you know, how they can actually radicalize people themselves, where these people would probably, if it's left to their own devices, it would just peter out. You know, the parents would deal with it, the local police would deal with it, the local mosque would deal with it. But, you know, they're kind of inventing these problems. And I think with that 13-year-old boy, it really reveals that, because, you know, when we see terrorists being arrested and these cases coming up on the news, they always have the picture of the guy with the knife, you know, with a slogan, with a banner. And this just shows that they are trying to get those pictures as evidence, you know. And when we see those pictures on the news, we think straight away, oh, brilliant, they've got another terrorist. But that guy would probably never make that picture if it wasn't for these, you know, intelligence agencies egging them on.
Well, this is the point, that ASIO actually stands for Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, and it is the Intelligence Service of Australia, their version of MI5. So they're working with the state police, they're working with the federal police, and it says it's the agency responsible for the protection of the country and its citizens from espionage. But actually what's going on is they're doing grooming of terrorists, because maybe they don't have any terrorists, so they've got to find terrorists to make some work for themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right, I think. Yeah, so I mean, and the other thing, I don't know if you want to talk about it now, is the I've been looking into the connection with the Order of Nine Angles and the March 15th terrorist attack in New Zealand, Christchurch.
Okay, and this is the mosque massacre. Yep. I think, wasn't that 2018 or 2019?
2019, I think.
2019, yeah, that's right. The year before the, we were there actually, and the year before the pandemic kicked off. And this was a horrific, like, I think it was 54 worshippers were killed in Christchurch in these two mosques by this chappy Brenton Tarrant, who was bizarrely filmed the whole thing on Facebook. And then because there was some evidence that he wasn't doing it alone, that he did seem to have some help, it seems for that reason, and for obviously the reason that, you know, on the film is people being murdered, the New Zealand government actually made it illegal to possess this video. But actually, of course, it's quite important for journalists to be able to do so and to scrutinise it. Yeah. But anyway, so what do you think is the link between 09A and the mosque massacres?
Yeah, well, I've been looking at the 09A, and it seems, you know, it could be a very similar operation as it's kind of the other side of the chessboard, you know, the more far right side rather than the Islamic sort of state side. And it could also be an intelligence operation, this 09A, because, I mean, it's like you said, is the UK government seems very reluctant to ban the 09A. They seem quite open to having it around. And also, you know, you don't hear much about it. You know, if you look online, there is a lot of stuff out there about it, you know. And in the UK, I think there's four or five cases of young men who, you know, got in far too deep and did end up, you know, murdering someone or several people, you know. So it's definitely out there and it's definitely real.
Yeah, I mean, can I just say, because they definitely target the military, the Order of the Nine Angles as well.
and there was a case where somebody who was part of this group was in the military. I think it was in a US Army unit, and was trying to organize an attack against his own unit, and he was discovered and arrested, etc. It's called by the BBC a UK Nazi Satanist group, and campaigners have been urging for a long time now for the Home Office to ban it, but the Home Office have been resisting that in Britain. Order of the Nine Angles is actually a very good BBC article about this from 2020, the year after the mosque massacre, where Daniel de Simone on the BBC website says a British neo-Nazi Satanist group should be outlawed by the government as a terrorist organization. Hope Not Hate has used its annual State of Hate report to call for the Order of Nine Angles 09A to be banned. The Home Office said the list of proscribed terrorist groups was kept under review. And one of the groups last week, which was added to it, Sonnenkrieg Division, was influenced by the 09A's Nazi Satanist ideology. So they are banning some groups which are influenced by the Order of the Nine Angles and picking up ideas and diabolical ideology from them, but not Order of the Nine Angles themselves.
Yeah, well, the Order of the Nine Angles is, you know, they encourage people who are interested to join the military, to join the police, you know, anywhere where you could potentially murder someone, because basically in the Order of the Nine Angles, to the first step to being an official member is to literally murder someone, you know, and once you've murdered them, you're supposed to say a satanic prayer above their body, you know, which is pretty disturbing. And so this is what they are, and they are accelerationists, you know, because even I was looking at the manifesto of Brenton Tarrant, and he has got a heading there, accelerationism, and you know, their belief is let me just quote it here. It's stability and comfort are the enemies of revolutionary change. So and this ties in perfectly with what the Order of the Nine Angles believe, you know. And they've also got another esoteric idea of the hero, and they've got several steps in becoming a hero, you know. So what it is you have to travel, well, the way the Order of the Nine Angles interpret this is you have to travel alone around the world to many different countries, you know, and once you return, you know, you can reap the rewards, you know, you will become a hero, you know, and you will have learned all of this knowledge and so on, you know. This is what they believe. And you know, that on this journey it could be possible, let's say, to murder someone easier than if you're in your own country, because you could you know, make a hasty escape. And this is the ideas they're trying to put out there and create chaos and accelerate us to the, you know, the end of the world almost, you know. And this is their idea, you know. And they want to try and you know, they're trying to do blood sacrifice, you know. So a lot of this comes from kind of Mayan culture, you know, of blood sacrifice, and you're going to have a demon come to you and possess you, you know. So they one idea is that you should stay up all night, you know, in nature, and they're big fans of nature, you know. You should stay in nature all night, and you're trying to open a stargate, they believe, and bring down a demon from the heavens above, or stars, you know. So they got some very funny ideas, you know.
Having said that, I mean, I think there is a genuine sort of appeal of like spending the night out under the stars, especially when it's not pouring with rain and it's reasonably warm, like in a nice New Zealand summer, and you haven't got any kind of wild giant cats prowling around, that sort of thing. But so you can see this is quite appealing. But I think it's important just to stress that this is a very real organisation, and it's not some sort of fantasy. I mean, ABC News reported just last year in March 2023. An American soldier, Ethan Meltzer, Ethanmelzer. He was described as the enemy within, and he was sentenced for a jihadist plot. He was an ex-army private, and he plotted an attack on his fellow soldiers. So he was sentenced to 45 years in prison. A former army private described as the enemy within because he plotted with satanic neo-Nazi group known as the Order of the Nine Angles to kill his fellow soldiers. He pleaded guilty to three counts, aiding and abetting the attempt to murder US servicemen, providing material support and resources to terrorists, and illegally transmitting transmitting national defense information. He attempted to plan a jihadist attack on his own army unit in the days leading up to deployment in Turkey, sending sensitive details to other members of the UK-based Order of the Nine Angles. The attack never came to fruition. And in May 2020, with the intent that US service members be killed, he said, "I disclosed sensitive information about my army unit's upcoming deployment to individuals I communicated with online in the messaging app Telegram. I'm sorry," he said, "I regret every single thing I did." But the fact of the matter is, he was most definitely part of this Order of the Nine Angles.
Yeah, so, and I mean, with Tarrant, I mean, we know that he was in contact with many, many far-right groups, you know, so there's a very high possibility that he'd have come into at least one group, which is, you know, having contact with Order of the Nine Angles. Because another thing with the Order of the Nine Angles is you're not really meant to tell anybody. So within far-right groups, some members may be part of the Order of the Nine Angles, and the rest of the group wouldn't know. But, you know, obviously you're going to be spreading this around with your mates, you know. You're going to be telling them, "Oh, look up this website," or so-and-so, you know. And they can easily get into it that way. And with the whole hero thing, you know, we know that Brenton Tarrant traveled the world, you know, and that is a clear indication. It's one of the key things with Order of the Nine Angles, you know, to follow that path, you know. And he'd be one of the few people who could actually do it, because he was left an inheritance to do that. And not only was he traveling, and he was also donating, obviously, to a lot of these far right groups. So we know he's involved in this this world. And just looking at some of the symbols on his gun, I mean, one I just wanted to pick up on was he had scrawled on the gun is Vienna 1683. And this is something that I think people don't often talk about, is this was a battle where the first time where the European Christians all worked together to take out the Muslims, the Persian Muslims, you know, out of Vienna. And this all happened in 1683 on September the 11th. And something that people don't talk about, I never hear it talked about much, is you know, the whole idea of 9/11, the Twin Towers, is kind of a revenge attack from the Muslims, you know, onto the free world for the Vienna 1683 attack. And it's something that I never hear much about, you know. And they've even made a film in the far right world. There's a film called, I think it's called The Siege or something like this. And it's all about this battle, and they worship this battle, the far right Christians, let's say.
Not sure if Christians is quite the right word. Satanists is probably a better word. But of course, you know, that's the idea here, is that if you're into this kind of satanic Nazi stuff, then you can pretend as a nihilist would, you know, to be into anything really. And if you can pretend to be your enemy, then of course that discredits your enemy, and you've fulfilled that role. But anyway, great stuff from Andy. I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Later later, and if we're having a week where Michael Gove is talking about extremism, well, what about this British-based group, the Order of the Nine Angles, where in order to become a serious member of it, you have to commit a murder, where you're actually tied in with this far-right ideology of race and divide and rule, where you're, as David Livingston has explained, it links to people like Charles Manson in the United States just trying to start race wars, this kind of thing. So we're drilling down into this sort of thing, and I'm amazed to see that the Order of the Nine Angles doesn't appear, and you do wonder whether the government is actually complicit with this sort of group, and perhaps that the Bilderbergers, or more specifically MI5 and the Home Office, are part of the Order of the Nine Angles, actually encouraging this sort of thing. But well done, Andy, anyway, for digging out particularly to do with the details of Order of Nine Angles. What do they actually do? What do they believe? And connecting them up with the Brenton Tarrant, the Christchurch Mosque Massacre chap. Excellent stuff. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please share interviews with us. The easiest way to do that is via whatever means you want to do it, but via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. You can also subscribe to my weekly newsletter or even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next week at 5 p.m. God bless, and don't let the Order of the Nine Angles satanic banksters get you down.
much.
Thank you. Thanks very much indeed.
Freak out. You freak, say she. Freak out. Freak out. You freak, say she. Freak out. Have you heard about the new dance craze? Listen to us, I'm sure you'll be amazed. Big fun to be had by everyone.